Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, September 27, 2021. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on a weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to nationallibertyalliance.org. And please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of the website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on the donation tab on the top right-hand side. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last week in our scripture reading. We're in the Gospel of Luke. And we'll be picking up in chapter 3, read by Alexander Scorby.
Chapter 3. Now, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea and of the region of Trachonitis, and Lysanias, the tetrarch of Abilene, Annas and Caiaphas being the high priests, the word of God came unto John, the son of Zacharias, in the wilderness. And he came into all the country about Jordan, preaching the baptism of repentance for the remission of sins, as it is written in the book of the words of Esaias the prophet, saying, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness, Prepare ye the way of the Lord, make his paths straight. Every valley shall be filled, and every mountain and hill shall be brought low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough ways shall be made smooth, and all flesh shall see the salvation of God." Then said he to the multitude that came forth to be baptized of him, "O generation of vipers, who hath warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Bring forth therefore fruits worthy of repentance, and begin not to say within yourselves, We have Abraham to our father. For I say unto you, that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. And now also the axe is laid unto the root of the trees. Every tree therefore which bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire." And the people asked him, saying, "What shall we do then?" He answereth and saith unto them, "He that hath two coats, let him impart to him that hath none. And he that hath meat, let him do likewise." Then came also publicans to be baptized, and said unto him, "Master, what shall we do?" And he said unto them, "Exact no more than that which is appointed you." And the soldiers likewise demanded of him, saying, "And what shall we do?" And he said unto them, "Do violence to no man, neither accuse any falsely, and be content with your wages." And as the people were in expectation, and all men mused in their hearts of John, whether he were the Christ or not, John answered, saying unto them all, "I indeed baptize you with water, but one mightier than I cometh, the latchet of whose shoes I am not worthy to unloose. He shall baptize you with the Holy Ghost and with fire, whose fan is in his hand, and he will throughly purge his floor, and will gather the wheat into his garner. But the chaff he will burn with fire unquenchable." And many other things in his exhortation preached he unto the people. But Herod the Tetrarch, being reproved by him for Herodias his brother Philip's wife, and for all the evils which Herod had done, added yet this above all, that he shut up John in prison. Now when all the people were baptized, it came to pass that Jesus also being baptized and praying, the heaven was opened, and the Holy Ghost descended in a bodily shape like a dove upon him, and a voice came from heaven which said, "Thou art my beloved Son, in thee I am well pleased." And Jesus himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, which was the son of Heli, which was the son of Matthat, which was the son of Levi, which was the son of Melchi, which was the son of Janna, which was the son of Joseph, which was the son of Mattathias, which was the son of Amos, which was the son of Nahum, which was the son of Esli, which was the son of Nagi, which was the son of Maath, which was the son of Mattathias, which was the son of Semei, which was the son of Joseph, which was the son of Judah, which was the son of Joanna, which was the son of Risa, which was the son of Zerubbabel, which was the son of Salathiel, which was the son of Neri, which was the son of Melchi, which was the son of Adai, which was the son of Kosam, which was the son of Elmodam, which was the son of Ur, which was the son of Josie, which was the son of Eliezer, which was the son of Joram, which was the son of Mattath, which was the son of Levi, which was the son of Simeon, which was the son of Judah, which was the son of Joseph, which was the son of Jonan, which was the son of Eliakim, which was the son of Meliah, which was the son of Menan, which was the son of Mattatha, which was the son of Nathan, which was the son of David, which was the son of Jesse, which was the son of Obed, which was the son of Boaz, which was the son of Salmon, which was the son of Naasson, which was the son of Aminadab, which was the son of Aram, which was the son of Ezram, which was the son of Phares, which was the son of Judah, which was the son of Jacob, which was the son of Isaac, which was the son of Abraham, which was the son of Thera, which was the son of Nacor, which was the son of Sarek, which was the son of Ragor, which was the son of Phalek, which was the son of Heber, which was the son of Selah, which was the son of Cainan, which was the son of Arphaxad, which was the son of Sem, which was the son of Noe, which was the son of Lamech, which was the son of Methuselah, which was the son of Enoch, which was the son of Jared, which was the son of Malaleel, which was the son of Cainan, which was the son of Enos, which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of God.
Okay, tonight we're going to take a look at part three. Last week we kind of skipped part three. We did read the first two parts of the Jurist Handbook. Let's see if I can believe I have that open. Yep. We're going to be looking at the Jurist Handbook and picking up in the Federal Rules. I think that's on page 16. And this is part three of four parts. And after that, right now the queue is open. So if anybody wants to get into the queue, but I really want only people to get into the queue first that might have some questions on this, or comments or thoughts on this Jurist Handbook. This handbook is really, really an enlightening handbook. It definitely would enlighten anybody who is ready to sit as a jurist, whether a grand jurist or a petit jurist, and definitely is at least the basic knowledge that we should all have and know, bare minimum, right here in this booklet. And again, it gives us a really good understanding that we the people are the lawmakers. And that's very important. The sovereign makes the law. Not the judges, not the legislators, not anyone in power or authority, but the people themselves. They make the law. We wrote the law through the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, of course, the Declaration of Independence, which is the foundation of our law. We wrote that law, and we put our government underneath that law. We, the people, are above that law. We established and ordained this Constitution for the United States of America, and we judge that law. We gave these people the authority to legislate, that is the government, the authority to legislate law in equity only, which governs themselves, and is made up of some 57 U.S. codes on a federal level. Of course, each state has the same powers and authorities in equity alone, not in law. They can make no decisions in law at all. The idea that they wanted to, the rules of civil procedure, which we can look at in a few minutes, really have destroyed the process of law. And they make these rules up and they try to govern the courts that way. The courts were to go, respond or be put underneath the rules of the common law. I think we saw that a little earlier, but we're going to be looking up the rules of common law also. A little more, but I think we did look somewhat on the rules of the common law a little earlier. But maybe not. I'm thinking because this part of this is recorded. In 1934, as we're going to look at, that's when they came up with the power and the authority to give to the United States Supreme Court the ability to write the rules of the civil procedure, which came, went into effect in 1938, which was an act of treason, destroyed the common law completely, annihilated it, removed it from the courts. Constitution is no longer held in the courts. Sometimes it is, only because the people are seeing it and too much is realized and they have to, you know, bend a little bit. But these past 10 or so years, maybe a little longer, they don't care at all. You're just not going to have your unalienable rights because they decided you can't have them. So the people are the ones that are supposed to decide this. We, the people, are the ones that decide whether someone is going to be indicted. We, the people, have the power and the authority to do a presentation, to a presentment. And a presentment is something that the jury acts upon on its own accord. It is an indictment, but it's called a presentment. And an indictment is one where the government or some official, maybe a sheriff particularly, brings charges against somebody into a court. And tries to bring it into a court of law, but brings it before the grand jury. And the grand jury decides, the people decide, yeah, we think that there was a law broken and this person is most likely, possibly, the individual that's guilty of the crime or whatever the case may be. And then the people decide innocent or guilt. And if they try to apply some codes, if the state tries to apply some codes, maybe the individual is working for an agency and a government agency and is operating under codes, under statutes and procedures. And so therefore they do apply to those people. But if the people don't like that code, don't like that law, it's referred to as positive law, but it's statutes. It's legislative law. And if the people don't like that law, they negate it. If they don't like the suggested penalty, they negate it. And they make their own law right up, right there and then. We make the law. The sovereigns make the law. And once a judge takes control of the sovereign, takes control of the juries, the grand juries, when the government takes control of that, then we are no longer sovereign. And they become the sovereign. And unfortunately, that's where we're at today. Okay, so we're going to look at this, and I'm going to take questions in this area only. And if nobody has any questions, then we'll move on to the next step here. I don't know if Gerard's here. Has anyone seen Gerard tonight? And Terry or Jan, let me know when Brent gets in.
Checked in just a few minutes ago, John.
Okay, all right. Brent? Oh, yeah, Brent just checked in. I see that now. Okay. All right, keep an eye out for Gerard. Okay, we're going to go look at this. And again, we're picking up. This is part three. And let me take a quick look. I think page 16. So anyway, after this, we're going to take questions or comments or thoughts on this subject matter, after which we'll switch to our next step. Right, this is part three of four parts of the Jurist Handbook. You can find a copy of the Jurist Handbook at nationallibertyalliance.org. On the blue bar, find People's Duty. Come down to Handbooks, and you'll find it on that page. All right, we're picking up where we left off on our last part. We had ended on page 16. We're picking up on 16. We're looking at the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, an act of treason. The Rules Enabling Act of 1934, passed by Congress in 1934, gave the Supreme Court the power to make rules of procedure and evidence for federal courts, as long as they did not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right. According to the Federal Judicial Center, a government agency, on September 16, 1938, pursuant to its fictional authority under the repugnant Rules Enabling Act of 1934, the United States Supreme Court enacted uniform rules of procedure for the federal courts. Under the new rules, suits in equity and suits at common law were grouped together under the term civil action, claiming that rigid application of common law rules brought about injustice. This was an act of treason, whereas the Supreme Court and Congress, under the teachings and guidance of the treacherous, subversive American Bar Association, in an act of treason, a silent coup, claiming the abrogation of common law, also known as natural law, with its unalienable rights that were endowed by our Creator, covertly substituted them with civil rights, legislated by lawless men. Thereafter, all 50 states, their counties, cities, towns, and villages, having incorporated, thereby becoming municipalities, which wrote municipal law, also known as civil law. Civil law, Roman law, and Roman civil law are exchangeable phrases, more properly called municipal law, to distinguish it from the law of nature. Because the people have been kept ignorant of the law and are not taught civics or constitutional studies in school, they have no idea what their heritage, being liberty under common law, is. Nor do they know what civil law is, which is used to control the behavior of the masses and fleece them of their property. Neither Congress nor the judiciary had the authority to abrogate common law and its common law rules. That was an act of treason. Only we the people can overturn the treasonous act via education and nullification, and it starts right here with a fully informed jury. Rules of the common law. We did not give Congress or the judiciary power to legislate or enforce civil or criminal statutes which are disguised as law and written by tyrants to conceal the common law and control the behavior of the people. They have been deluded into believing we are their subjects. All judges are bound by their oath to the supreme law of the land, also known as the Constitution under Article 6, Clause 2, which states, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all the treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or the law of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Any judge who does not comply with this oath to the Constitution of the United States wars against that Constitution and engages in acts in violence of the supreme law of the land. The judge is engaged in acts of treason. Rules are an established standard, guide, or regulations, a principle or regulation set up by authority prescribing or directing action or restraint. Under common law, common sense set up by nature's government are the rules of common law. Black's Law states, common law, as distinguished from equity law, it is a body of rules and principles, written or unwritten, which are of fixed and immutable authority, and which must be applied to controversies rigorously and in their entirety, and cannot be modified to suit the particularities of a specific case or colored by any judicial discretion, and which rest confessively upon custom or statute, as distinguished from any claim to ethical superiority. Common law eludes definition because it is not a list of laws. It is not built upon precedents or a collection of equity court rulings. Common law is written into the hearts and minds of men, being naturally common unto all men. For even the godless, having not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, showing the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness. Common law is the law of nature and of nature's God that proceed upon two self-evident truths called maxims. Number one, for every injury there must be a remedy. And number two, in order for there to be a crime, there must be an injured party without which no court may proceed. Maxims are brief statements of self-evident truths that control our common law courts. They provided discernment in the writings of our founding documents. It is an advisor to our legislatures and every consideration of mankind that seeks what's fair and best for all. maxims. Courts that do not honor or consider these maxims are not just. Indeed, whether and or to what extent these common law maxims are honored by public leaders is how we test the way they administer the law to govern. Our courts were established to enforce these principles of common law. The word justice is synonymous with virtue, and virtue is a biblical principle that emanates from Jesus Christ alone. Maxims are the laws that never change. These statements set essential limits on truth and are essential to the fair and efficient administration of justice according to the common law of mankind. No right-thinking person can disagree with a maxim. Every court is bound by the common law rules of equity, established by the never-changing maxims. Maxims test those who judge and put an absolute limit on those who rule. Maxims are self-evident, indisputable truths that are the results of human reason and experience used to adjudicate common law cases. Maxims are our common law heritage and bind us together as a people. If everyone knew the maxims of common law, our world would be a far better place. The following is a short list of maxims, also known as self-evident truth or just common sense. Maxims on principles of common law. All men are created equal. Men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Liberty to all, but preference to none. The safety of people is the supreme law. The safety of people cannot be judged but by the safety of every individual. To lie is to go against the mind. The only one who has any capacity or right or responsibility or knowledge to rebut your affidavit of truth is the one who is adversely affected by it. It's his job, his right, his responsibility to speak for himself. No one else can know what your truth is or had the free will responsibility to state it. This is your job. Each of us is entitled to equal treatments under the law. A workman is worthy of his hire. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. Maxims on the legitimacy of government. Just governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. Unjust is a state power where the law is either uncertain or unknown. The state should be subject to the law, for the law creates the state. The judge who decides a case without hearing both parties, though his decisions be just, is himself unjust. Courts of justice are for the common people to command the power of the state. Maxims on testimony and evidence. Words should be considered only as commonly understood and not with a meaning others construe to their own purpose. No one should be believed in a court except upon his oath. Courts should not believe water runs upward of its own accord, nor that impossibilities exist. The certainty of a thing in court arises only from making the thing certain in court. Maxims on civic duties of citizens. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government. Each should use his own power and property so as not to unjustly injure another. Maxims on private property. There is nothing more sacred, more inviolate, than the house of every citizen. Every home is a castle. Though the winds of heaven blow through it, office of the state cannot enter. Title is the right to enjoy possession of that which is our own. Maxims on unalienable rights. The Bill of Rights is a list of self-evident truths. None has a greater claim to live free. No one should be required to betray himself, i.e., no one should be made to testify against himself. The right of the people to keep and bear arms is a necessity for the security of a free state. Everyone should be presumed innocent until his guilt is established beyond a reasonable doubt. Liberty to all, but preference to none. None is entitled to any privilege denied to others, absolutely none. It is against justice for free men not to have the free disposal of their own property. No king, no priest, no celebrity, no judge, nor any person has any greater right to walk free than any lowly carpenter, plumber, or law-abiding street minstrel. Maxims on crime and punishment. He who acts in pure defense of his own life or limb is justified. Crimes are more effectually prevented by certainty than by severity of punishment. Perjured witnesses should be punished for perjury and for the crimes they falsely accused against others. For a crime to exist, there must be an injured party, corpus delicti, the body of a crime. There can be no sanction or penalty imposed on one because of his constitutional right. With no injured party, a complaint is invalid on its face. For every injury, there must be a remedy. Maxims on judicial reasoning. The burden of proof lies on him who asserts the fact, not on him who denies it, because from the very nature of things, a negative cannot be proof. No one should be twice harassed for the same offense. We are all equal in the sight of our law. Maxims test those who judge. Maxims put an absolute limit on those who rule. He who slices the pie should be the last to take a piece. Servant judges cannot judge sovereigns. A thing similar is not exactly the same thing. Innocent until proven guilty. No one is above the law. Words should be considered only as commonly understood and not with a meaning others construe to their own purpose. All are equal under the law. Truth is expressed in the form of an affidavit. An unrebutted affidavit stands as truth. He who leaves the battlefield first loses by default. Sacrifice is the measure of credibility. A lien or claim can be satisfied only through rebuttal by affidavit, point by point, resolution by jury, or payment. He who bears the burden ought also derive the benefit. If a plaintiff does not prove his case, the defendant is absolved. No court and no judge can overturn or disregard or abrogate someone's affidavit of truth. Words should be interpreted most strongly against him who uses them. You can find Maxims of Law from Bouvier's 1856 Law Dictionary, The Lawful Path, and Sir Edward Coke's Maxims at nationallibertyalliance.org. In conclusion, there are thousands of maxims and many yet to be discovered. They are simply pure logic and justness, clearly seen by any reasonable person, also known as common sense. Maxims are only denied by the lawless and tyrants. The petit jury, the 8 stages of trial. The trial proceeds when the jury has been orientated in natural law and sworn in. There are usually 8 stages of the trial in civil cases. They are: both sides present opening statements. Number 2, the plaintiff calls witnesses and produces evidence to prove its case. Number 3, the defendant may call witnesses and produce evidence to disprove the plaintiff's case and to prove the defendant's claim. 4, the plaintiff may call rebuttal witnesses to disprove what was said by the defendant's witnesses. Number 5, the defendant may call rebuttal witnesses to disprove what was said by the plaintiff's witnesses. Number 6, closing arguments are made on each side. Number 7, the jury retires to deliberate. Number 8, the jury reaches its verdict and decides the penalty with the eye on restitution. During the trial, witnesses called by either side may be cross-examined by the other side. After presentation of the evidence is complete, both sides have the opportunity to discuss the evidence in their closing arguments. This helps the jurors recall testimony that might have slipped their memory. The chief purpose of the argument is to present the evidence in logical and comprehensible order, fitting the different parts of the testimony together and connect up the facts. It is the juror's duty to reach its own conclusions based on the evidence. The verdict is reached without regard to what may be the opinion of the magistrate as to the facts of the law. The magistrate is not to give his or her opinion to the jury. That would be jury tampering. Conduct of the jury during the trial. Common courtesy and politeness are safe guides as to the way jurors should act. Of course, no juror will be permitted to read a newspaper or magazine in the courtroom, nor should a juror carry on conversations with other jurors on the courtroom during the trial. Jurors will be treated with consideration for their comfort and convenience. They should bring to the attention of the jury administrators any matter affecting their services and should notify the court of any emergencies in the event of a personal emergency. The juror may send word to the magistrate through any court personnel or may ask to see the magistrate privately. Jurors should give close attention to the testimony and disregard their prejudices and render a verdict according to their best judgment. Each juror should keep an open mind. Human experience shows that one person comes to a preliminary conclusion as to a set of facts. They hesitate to change their views. Therefore, it is wise for jurors not to even attempt to make up their minds on the facts of the case until all the evidence has been presented to them. Similarly, jurors should not discuss the case even among themselves until it is concluded. The mere fact that a lawsuit has begun is not evidence in a case. The opening and closing statements of the lawyers are not evidence. A juror should disregard any statement made by a lawyer in argument that they have not proved by the evidence. Jurors are expected to use all the experience, common sense, and common knowledge they possess, but they are not to rely on a private source of information. Thus, they should be careful during the trial not to discuss the case at home or elsewhere. Information that a juror gets from a private source may be only half true or biased or inaccurate. It may be irrelevant to the case at hand. At any rate, it is only fair that the parties have a chance to know and comment on all the facts that matter in the case. If during a trial the juror learns elsewhere of some facts about the case, he or she should inform the court. The juror should not mention any such matter in the jury room. Individual jurors should never inspect, either in person or via internet website, the scene of the accident or any event in the case. If an inspection is necessary, the magistrate will have the jurors go to as a group to the scene. Jurors must not talk about the case with others on the jury, even their spouses or families, including via electronic communication and social networking on computers, netbooks, tablets, and smartphones. Jurors must not read about the case in the newspaper or on the internet. They should avoid radio, television, and internet broadcasting that might mention the case. Jurors should not conduct any outside research, including but not limited to consulting dictionaries or reference material, whether in paper form or on the internet. Jurors may not use any of the following to obtain information about the case, about the process or legal terms or the conduct, any research about the case, any electronic device or media, such as a telephone, cell phone, smartphone, or computer, the internet, any internet service, or any text or instant messaging services, RSS feeds, or other automatic alert that may transmit information regarding the case to the juror, or any internet chat room, blog, or website to communicate to anyone information about the case. The Sixth Amendment guarantees of a trial by an impartial jury requires that a jury's verdict must be based on nothing else but the evidence presented to them in court. The words of Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes from over a century ago apply with equal force to jurors serving in the advanced technological age. The theory of our system is that the conclusion is to be reached in the case will be introduced only by evidence and argument in open court. and not by any outside influence, whether of private talk or public print. Breaking these rules is likely to confuse a juror. It may be hard to separate in one's mind the court testimony and reports coming from other sources. Jurors should not loiter in the corridors or vestibules of the courthouse. Embarrassing and/or improper contacts may occur there with persons interested in the case. Juror identification badges are provided. They should be worn in the courthouse at all times. If any outsider attempts to talk with the juror about a case in which he or she is sitting, the juror should do the following. Number one, tell the person it is improper for a juror to discuss the case or receive any information except in the courtroom. Number two, refuse to listen if the outsider persists. Number three, report the incident at once to the court. Jurors have a duty to report to the court any improper behavior by any juror. They also have a duty to inform the court of any outside communications or improper conduct directed at the jury by any persons. Jurors on a case should refrain from talking on any subject, even if it is not related to the matter being tried, with any lawyer, witness, or party in the case. Such contact may make a new trial necessary. At significant additional expense to the parties, the court, and ultimately taxpayers. Some cases may arouse much public discussion. In that event, the jury may be kept together until the verdict is reached. This procedure is used to protect the jurors against outside influences. The jury decides law and facts. The trial of all crimes shall be by jury. A trial is the judicial examination in accordance with the law of the land of a cause, either civil or criminal, of the issue between the parties, whether of law or fact, before a court that has jurisdiction over it. For purpose of determining such issues, it includes all proceedings from time when the issue is joined, or more usually when parties are called to try their case in court, to time of a final determination. And in its strict definition, the word trial in criminal procedure means the proceeding in open court after the pleadings are finished and the prosecution is otherwise ready, down to and including the rendition of the verdict. Kentucky Resolutions, a series of resolutions drawn up by Jefferson and adopted by the legislature of Kentucky in 1799, protesting against the Alien and Sedition Laws, declaring their illegality, announcing the strict constructionalist theory of the federal government, and declaring nullification to be the rightful remedy. New York Constitution, Article 1, Section 8. The jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts. Marbury v. Madison. All laws, rules, and practices which are repugnant to the Constitution are null and void. Miranda v. Arizona. Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. The final arbiter of all things. The decision of a superior court may only be challenged in a court of appeal. The decision of an inferior court are subject to collateral attack. In other words, in a superior court, one may sue an inferior court directly rather than resort to appeal to an appellate court. Decisions of a court of record, that's a trial by jury, may not be appealed. It is binding on all other courts. However, no statutory or constitutional court, whether it be an appellate or a Supreme Court, can second-guess the judgment of a court of record. The judgments of a court of record, which is a trial by jury, whose jurisdiction is final, is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be. It is conclusive on the court as it is on other courts. It puts an end to the inquiry concerning the facts by deciding it. That was Ex parte and Watkins, 3 Peter. We the people are the most qualified to make and decide law, because we are the author of the law, and we vested Congress with statute-making powers, that we, the people, in our courts of justice, reserve the right to consent or deny by nullification, according to the facts of the case, as we see fit. Furthermore, as a nation, we called upon our Creator in our founding documents to be the king of our court of justice, and not man, whereas we read, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal stations to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinion of mankind requires that they should declare the cause which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Declaration of Independence. And by His grace and holy will, we the people in 1789 were gifted with His liberty to be what man was meant to be, free and independent. A consequence of this prerogative is the legal ubiquity of the king. His majesty, in the eye of the law, is always present in his court, of course that is God, though he cannot personally distribute justice. His judges, it's we the people as the jury, both the grand or the petit, are the mirror by which the king's image is reflected. That's the Lord's justice. Since then, 1789, we have been engaged in a battle against the rulers of darkness over the control of our courts as the final day of Leviathan draws nigh. We the people sit on the king's bench and are able to reflect his holy will as we read in his word, "This shall be the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, saith the Lord, I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and will be their God, and they will be my people." God, Jeremiah 31:33. "This is the covenant that I made with them after the days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their hearts and in their minds, and I will write them." God, in Hebrews 10:16. "Therefore, to permit the servant to rule the master is absurd, and as recent years have proven, the control of our courts by bar members throughout the last half of the 20th century has brought we the people under the rule of despotism, of an oligarchy, as Jefferson has warned. We the people of the king's bench, being the jury, being the source and arbiter of the law, have a duty and an unalienable right to judge and decide in all things which include sentencing with an eye on restitution as the tribunal of the lawful court. To deny our unalienable right to consent of these things is to war against we the people, thereby our word is final." The jury's decision is final. This is government by consent. The jury's decision is final, and no court in the land can overturn the decision. It is solely the jury's duty to decide both the facts and the law in harmony with their conscience and their sense of justice. In common law, the law is written in the hearts of men. We can all discern when an injury has taken place and how the injured party can best be restored and compensated for their injuries. Common law requires that for every injury there must be a remedy. A prison sentence should only be considered in violent cases, and at the end of the day, mercy should always be considered. In the jury room, the administrator will assist the jurors in the election of their foreperson. The foreperson presides over the jury's deliberation and must give every juror a fair opportunity to express his or her views. Jurors must enter the discussion with open minds. They should freely exchange views. They should not hesitate to change their opinions. If the deliberations have convinced them, they were wrong initially. In all criminal and civil cases, all jurors must agree on a verdict. Jurors start to proceed with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy, and if necessary, remind each other from time to time. The jurors have a duty to give full consideration to the opinion of their fellow jurors. They have an obligation to reach a verdict. However, no juror is required to give up any opinion which he or she is convinced is correct. The members of the jury are sworn to pass judgment on the facts in a particular case. They have no concern beyond that case. They violate their oath if they render their decision on the basis of the effect their verdict may have on other situations. Petit jurors are obligated to bring in a verdict and are not to be released from the duty until they meet that obligation. A unanimous decision must be met to render a guilty verdict. If the petit jury believes that they are deadlocked and agree that they cannot come to an agreement on the verdict, they must return a verdict of not guilty. Whereas grand jurists require only a majority of the vote to bring an indictment or not. Jury's responsibility is to deliver justice, not uphold the law. It would be an absurdity for jurors to be required to accept the judge's view of the law against their own opinion, judgment, and conscience. John Adams. Unalienable right of the jury in sentencing. There is no statutory prescription against making the jury aware of possible punishment. Instead, courts that have disallowed juror awareness of sentencing contingencies have preemptorily resorted to the fact-finding sentencing dichotomy to justify this denial. For example, the Eighth Circuit in United States v. Goodface merely stated that the penalty to be imposed upon a defendant is not a matter of the jury, and as it was proper not to inform the jury of mandatory minimum term. No further justification is given. In making this factual distinction, the courts have created an artificial and poorly constructed fence around the juror's role. The Supreme Court has not mandated that jurors be in the dock on the issues of sentencing. Those courts so ruling have done so on unconvincing grounds. The power of jury nullification historically has extended to sentencing decisions, and it rightfully should extend to such decisions. This court finds no precedential rationale for rejecting the defendant's motion. After the trial. After the jurors return their verdict and are dismissed by the magistrate, they are free to go about their normal affairs. They are under no obligation to speak to any person about the case and may refuse all requests for interviews or comments. Nevertheless, the court may enter an order in a specific case that during any such interview, jurors may not give any information with respect to the vote of any other juror. Grand jurors. A grand jury is selected at random from a fair cross-section of the community in the county or federal district where the alleged crime occurred. Thus, all citizens have an equal opportunity and obligation to serve. Names of prospective grand jurors are drawn at random from lists of registered voters or other sources when necessary, under procedures designed to ensure that all groups in the community will have a fair chance to serve. Those persons whose names have been drawn and who are not exempt or excused from service are summoned to appear for duty as grand jurors. When these persons appear before the court, the presiding magistrate may consider any further request to be excused. The magistrate will then direct and select 25 persons to become the members of the grand jury. Grand jury procedures. Organization, oath, and offices. After the proper number of persons have been qualified as grand jurors, the jury administrator will assist jurors to the appointment of a foreman. A deputy foreman will also be appointed so that he or she can act as presiding officer in the foreman's absence. The foreman, the deputy foreman, and the remaining members of the jury are sworn in by the clerk of the court. The oath and the vow taken by the grand jurors bind them to inquire diligently and objectively into the crimes committed within the district of which they have or may obtain evidence, and to conduct such inquiry without malice, fear, hatred, or other emotion. After the grand jurors have been sworn, the jury administrator will orientate and advise the grand jury in its obligation and how best to inform its duties. Careful attention must be paid to the instructions that may be given. After orientation, the grand jury will hear testimony and consider documentary evidence in the case brought to its attention. Quorum. 13 of the 25 members of the grand jury constitute a quorum for the transaction of business. If fewer than 13 are present, even for a moment, the proceedings of the grand jury must stop. This shows how important it is that each grand jury conscientiously attend the meetings. If an emergency will prevent a grand juror attendance at the meeting, he or she must promptly advise the grand jury foreman. If the juror's absence will prevent the grand jury from acting, the grand juror should, if at all possible, attend the meeting. Evidence before the grand jury. Much of the grand jury's time is spent hearing testimony by witnesses and examining documentary or other evidence in order to determine whether such evidence justifies an indictment. The grand jury may then ask the additional witnesses be called if it believes this necessary. 4. Questioning the witness. Witnesses are called to testify one after another. Upon appearing to give testimony, each witness will be sworn in by the grand jury foreman or, in the foreman's absence, the deputy foreman. The witness will then be questioned by the foreman of the grand jury. Then the other members of the grand jury may question the witnesses. All questions asked of each witness must be relevant and proper, relating only to the case under investigation. If doubt should arise as to whether a question is appropriate, the advice of the jury administrator may be sought. Because of the need for secrecy, described in more detail in the following section, the law forbids anyone other than authorized persons from being present in the grand jury room while evidence is being presented. This means that only the grand jury, the jury administrator, those prosecuting the witness under examination, the court reporter, and interpreters, when needed, may be present. Occasionally, prior to answering a question, a witness may ask to leave the grand jury room to consult with his or her attorney. The grand jury is to draw no adverse influence from such conduct, for every witness has a right to confer with counsel, even though counsel may not be present in the grand jury room. In fact, a witness may confer with counsel after each question, as long as he or she does not make a mockery of the proceeding or does not, by such, make an attempt to impede the orderly progress of the grand jury investigation. 5. Calling the person under investigation as a witness. Normally, neither the person under investigation, sometimes referred to as the accused, although this does not imply he or she is guilty to any crime, nor any witness or on the accused behalf will testify before the grand jury. Upon request, preferably in writing, an accused may be given the opportunity by the grand jury to appear before it. An accused may be given the opportunity by the grand jury to appear before it. An accused who does not appear cannot be forced to testify because of the constitutional privilege against self-incrimination. Even if the accused is willing to testify voluntarily, it is recommended that he or she first be warned of the rights not to testify. Also, he or she may be required to sign a formal waiver of this right. The grand jury should be completely satisfied that the accused fully understands what he or she is doing. 6. The evidence needed before a true bill may be voted. It is the responsibility of the grand jury to weigh the evidence presented to it in order to determine whether this evidence, usually without any explanation being offered by the accused, persuades it that there is probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and that the accused was the person who committed it. Remember that the grand jury is not responsible for determining whether the accused is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but only whether there is sufficient evidence of probable cause to justify bringing the accused to trial. Only the evidence presented to the grand jury in a grand jury room may be considered in determining whether a vote of an indictment. 7. Deliberations. When the grand jury has received all the evidence on a given charge all persons other than the members of the grand jury or an interpreter to assist the jury who is hearing or speech impaired must leave the room so that the grand jury may begin its deliberation in private. After all persons other than the grand jury members and any interpreter for a hearing or speech impaired juror have left the room, the foreman will ask the grand jury member to discuss the vote upon the question of whether evidence persuaded the grand jury that a crime has probably been committed by the person accused and that an indictment should be returned. Every grand juror has the right to express his or her view of the matter under consideration, and grand jurors should listen to the comments of their fellow grand jurors before making up their mind. Only after each grand juror has been given the opportunity to be heard with the vote to be taken, it should be remembered that at least 13 jurors must be present and 12 members must vote in favor of the indictment before it may be returned. The foreman of the grand jury must keep a record of the number of jurors occurring in the finding of every indictment and file the record with the clerk of the court. If an indictment is found, the grand jury will report it to the magistrate. It will likewise report any not true bill or decisions not to indict. A decision not to indict should immediately be reported to the court in writing by the foreman so that the accused may promptly be released from jail or free from bail. Secrecy. The law imposes upon each grand jury a strict obligation of secrecy. This obligation is emphasized in the oath each grand juror takes and in the charge given to the grand jury by the magistrate judge. The tradition of secrecy continues as a vital part of the grand jury system for many reasons. It protects the grand jurors from being subjected to pressure by persons who may be subjects of the investigation by the grand jury or associates of such person. It prevents the escape of those against whom an indictment is being considered. It encourages witnesses before the grand jury to give full and truthful information as the commission of a crime. It also prevents tampering with or intimidation of such witnesses before they testify at a trial. Finally, it prevents the disclosure of an investigations that result in no action by the grand jury and avoids any stigma the public might attach to one who is the subject of a mere investigation by a grand jury. Essentially, the grand jury may disclose matters occurring before it only to the sheriff and or jury administrator for use in the performance of their duties. But even the sheriff and the jury administrator cannot be informed of what took place during the grand jury's deliberation and voting. Protection of grand jurors. The secrecy imposed upon the grand jury is a major source of protection for them. In addition, no inquiry may be made to learn what grand jurors said or how they voted. The law gives the members of the grand jury broad immunity for actions taken by them within the scope of their authority as grand jurors. Because of this immunity, all grand jurors must perform their duties with the highest sense of responsibility. Practical suggestions for grand jurors. Each juror should attend the grand jury sessions regularly in order to ensure that a quorum of 13 members will be present to conduct the grand jury business. Each juror should be on time for each meeting so that others are not kept waiting. The time of the meeting should be scheduled so as to the convenience of the grand jury and the witnesses. Witnesses should be treated courteously when they appear before the grand jury. Questions should be put to them in an orderly fashion. The sheriff should complete his or her questioning of each witness before the foreman asks questions. The remaining grand jurors will then have a chance to ask relevant and proper questions. Each juror has an equal voice in determining whether or not an indictment should be returned. Therefore, it is important that all grand jurors pay close attention to the testimony and other evidence presented. Each jury must be absolutely fair in his or her judgment of the facts. Otherwise, the grand jury will defeat the purpose the grand jury is designed to serve. During deliberations on a case, each grand juror should feel free to express his or her opinion based upon the evidence. Each juror has equal duties and responsibilities, and each is entitled to be satisfied with the evidence before being called upon to vote. No juror has the right to dismiss a witness or to shut off proper discussions if the other jurors wish to pursue the matter further. No jury should undertake to investigate matters outside its proper scope merely because someone suggested an investigation or because the investigation would be interesting. No juror should discuss the case under investigation with anyone except fellow grand jurors, and then only in the grand jury room. Of course, the grand jurors may always seek the advice of the jury administrator. Finally, every citizen who is selected to serve on a federal jury should bring to this task the determination to participate in a responsible manner and to make every effort to ensure that the grand jury will be a credit not only to the community it represents, but to the United States. Okay, that's the end of part three here. We'll pick up on the final part next week. It'll be the part four, and we'll pick up here on the juror's oath on page 28. Okay, before we go into some announcements maybe and any questions that were mailed in, we just want to focus in on what we have read here tonight. And again, this was part three of four parts. It is kind of long. It's 38 pages, but it's very important information that all of us should know and be aware of, and especially if we're going to sit as a jurist, be aware of. As a matter of fact, this particular handbook will be the criteria used in order to prepare and orientate the jurist. And we'll put together maybe some short videos or something, to really bring things through part by part over the course of an eight-hour period, which is the time period that the administrator has in order to orientate the jury, whether it be a grand jury or a petit jury. And a copy of this book, of course, should be handed out to each of the jurists, so they should have a copy of this handbook. All right, anybody who wants to go back and listen, last week we didn't do a part. We were supposed to do part three last week, but we had some technical problems, and then Gerard came in with some things and we wanted to discuss, so we kind of skipped this and went into another subject matter. But this was part three of four parts, and so if you go back, anybody that would like to go back and take a look at these, listen to these parts again, or read it. Again, you can find the booklet under People's Duty, come down to Handbooks, okay, click on Handbooks, and you will find the Jurist Handbook in here under PDFs. But also, you can go to the weekly call, and you can... listen to the earlier parts of this. As a matter of fact, it's even listed Handbook Part 1, Handbook Part 2, and then Handbook Part 3, which, of course, is tonight. Again, we had jumped over it last week. All right, if anybody has any questions or comments or any thoughts, and especially after Part 4 next week, if anybody sees anything that really should be corrected, or added that we didn't put into here that might be, vital that people should know, you should bring that forward. So, but we do have one person in the queue. If anybody else wants to get into the queue to ask a question, make a comment concerning the subject matter we just discussed or read through, and then after that, we'll go to Brent and then open up to an open forum after that. But we do have one person in the queue. Let me unmute them. Go right ahead. I don't know how to pronounce your name, but you got the mic. You've been unmuted.
Greetings.
How you doing?
I'm good. So I was listening, and when you started to talk about the court system, something that stood out to me was that they don't let you talk about the Constitution in court because... I guess because the courts are commercial in nature, and they will threaten to throw you in jail for contempt if you talk about the Constitution. Is that correct?
Unfortunately, that is true in many courts. I can't say it's in all courts, but it probably is. Our court systems have been totally polluted. They're polluted by the Bar Association specifically, who is responsible for all the problems we have here today. It's the Bar Association that writes most of the legislation. It's the Bar Association that wrote the rules for the court. And it was the Bar Association who has worked diligently since, we go back all the way to 1750 or 1760, when the original British Bar was established in the colonies. And at that point, even before 1776, was already distorting our courts and trying to break up the process of common law and pollute the juries and take control. And of course, they passed that on to the American Bar Association eventually in the late 1800s, then have taken it up. But they are the minions of the New World Order. They control everything. If you really look to see, they control all legislation. They work to empower and control the pharmaceuticals, our money system, our judicial system, our legislative system. They've taken control of ultimately, this is really the deep state behind it, but the Bar Association is the tool used in order to destroy. Now, of course, the booklet we wrote a while back, but this booklet that we've written for the jurists is intended for when we get to the other side, and that is when the military finally does their job and takes back this nation, gives it back to the people. And hopefully we, the people, will be able to receive that power, and authority, the rightful power and authority that the people deserve, and to step up and do what is necessary in order to have government by consent. And of course, that's the reason why we wrote the book, Government by Consent. And since I'm bringing that up, I just want to make a note, and I'm going to be sending an email out to let the people know, that the book, Government on Consent, again, we're trying to get this to every sheriff. And we had a person who donated enough sheriff books for his state, and every sheriff in that person's state has a book, or is getting a book. As a matter of fact, they'll be going out tomorrow. I'm not going to mention the state because, unfortunately, people think, well, I only got to bring a book to my sheriff. No, everybody needs to get partnership into this process of our getting constitutional sheriffs. This is our campaign for constitutional sheriffs. And the sheriff needs other sheriffs. They need the sheriffs next door and next door to them and so on. They need to be able to come together as a group, as a coalition, in order to defeat off government overreach, especially from the federal government. And so therefore, we need to get our books to sheriffs. I've got a lot of people who have written, did my sheriff get a book yet? And I'm not going to answer those questions because... again, if I tell them, well, yes, they got a book, why are they asking the question? Maybe so that they don't have to buy a book. Well, no, buy a book. It doesn't matter whether your sheriff gets your book or not. We have to, and if the sheriff next door gets your book, that just empowered your sheriff also. And I want to say I've had a phone call from one sheriff here in New York, very thankful and gracefully. We had a good conversation for a while and was very thankful of the book that we sent them, the gift, and was really encouraged. And matter of fact, he is already connected with Sheriff Darr and working, to be constitutional, to understand the law. And he said he was talking with other sheriffs, and they're really excited about this thing that we're doing. We also, from another sheriff, I got a letter, a thankful letter, thank you for the gift and so on and so forth. Nothing really deep or big, but hey, they responded. So sheriffs are responding, okay? Now, we've had people who said, well, look at my sheriff, he's no good, he's a criminal, why even bother? Well, that's okay. We'll get a criminal from time to time, and we'll deal with them. But the people will deal with them, of course. Brent, you got your mic open. We'll deal with those people. The people will deal with those people, shall I say, the people within their community. They'll get rid of them. They'll recall them, pull them out of office, and replace them with a sheriff who will uphold the Constitution. And remember, they are there to prevent an overreaching government. And believe me, as we all know, we have a lot of that. You know, the feds alone with, you know, the income tax, the IRS, and the assault upon the people, putting people in jail, debt is prison is what it is, putting people in jail, requiring them to pay the amounts that they claim that we should pay. And they make it up, too. They make these outrageous numbers up just to break you. And the sheriff can stop all that. The sheriff can prevent any federal agent from coming down trying to make an arrest or go through any process that is unlawful. Even the sheriff can also prevent them from filing within that county an unlawful paper claiming that there is a lien against the people. Because whenever the people get a notice of lien, what that is, it's supposed to be sworn statement that there is a notice of lien that exists in a federal district court that you live in, okay, and has been filed there, and for such amount and what it was for, and they file that in the county court. Then they use the sheriff to go out and collect or maybe even arrest you. So they're using sheriffs who are just don't have no knowledge of this. They don't understand this. And that's why we have to inform the sheriffs. And we have to inform all of the sheriffs around them in their state and the states next to that and the states next to that. Now, I don't know whether I said this because I was thinking it, I might have said this, but I'm going to say it again, that one person has paid and bought a sheriff's book for everybody, all sheriffs in that person's state. Okay, another person had done that a couple of weeks ago. So we have two states that every sheriff has a book. Two states. So anybody that has deep pockets, anybody that has the ability to give a couple of $1,000, you know, $2,000 will buy 40 books. So, and if you got 40 sheriffs or about 40 sheriffs, you know, if you can afford something like that, you should do it. This is the most, in my opinion, this is the most important thing that we the people can do. To educate and to give the tools of common law to our sheriffs and to educate and give the tools of common law to ourselves and our posterity, to our children. That's the most important thing that any of us can do. And when we take back this nation, remember, Trump and the military can only do so much. They can put these people in jail. They can take things back and give it back to the people. But if the people can't receive it, and if the people don't know what to do with it, that's the problem. As Jefferson said, if a people expect to be ignorant and free, they expect what never was and never will be. So forget about it. You can't have liberty. You can't have a government by consent unless you're educated in having so. And we don't have government by the majority. We have a government by the majority that participates. So we don't need, you know, all 300 million plus whatever people we have in the United States to become educated. We only need a handful of those people, you know, a small percentage of those people. We don't need them all. Because right now our government is controlled by a handful of people, maybe a couple of 100,000, okay? So if we the people in our counties, you know, if everyone in our county got involved, let's put it this way. If you get about 100 to 200, maybe even 300 people in your county involved, you become as powerful as the committee man. You take control of the committee man process. We don't need to be elected. Let's just go do it. Why should we even bother? You know, I've thought about this, and we've been teaching the committee man process for quite some time. We've got a lot of information up there. But I'm thinking about this. That's more of a control on the people. That's all statutes controlling us. Forget about that. We the people can come together as the committee man. We can walk the papers to get people into office. We can walk the papers to recall people, take them out of office. They did that in California recently with the governor. So we could take people out of office. And if necessary, if they need to be removed immediately or they're committing a crime, we can indict them. So the people need to take control of those two places to get involved in their community, countywide, working together with people from town to town in one place, coming together at least once a month, and acting as the responsible, you know, people to have government by consent. So we need to do these things. So please, we need to get the books to the sheriffs. We've had people asking, did my sheriff or did this sheriff? I'm not going to answer that question. When every sheriff gets a book, I'm going to tell you. And I'm not going to reveal the states. There are two states that have been completed now, two states. And we've only got 300 books, you know, sold out, was passed out to the sheriffs. So about 300 books now, I think it's like 289 or something like that. And I think I got a couple on my desk that I got to file up and put into the boxes and get out. So it may be just about 300 now. But just think about it. Two states have been sheriffs are being educated. And let's not worry about the enemy. The other thing is, you know, some people want to buy the book and give it to the sheriff. Well, we have to know that, because if they give it to the sheriff, we're going to send them another one. The other thing is we put in the book that this is the property of the office of the sheriff. This doesn't belong to the sheriff that's empowered at the moment that the book arrives. This is to the sheriff and to stay in that office. And we put a big note inside. I think we read it a couple of weeks ago, and maybe I'll read it again next week or something. But it's very clear that this is for educational purposes, that's meant to be stay with the sheriff and the sheriff's office, and to be passed down sheriff to sheriff. Because we have to have our sheriffs educated. And also, with the book, we also send two letters. One letter is written by Sheriff Darr, introducing our book and National Liberty Alliance and the need to know the common law. It's a short letter, but very strong, very powerful. And, of course, National Liberty Alliance has a letter that offering different things and that you know, they can come up and take our courses and so on and so forth. We have lots of, you know, handbooks. We have the sheriff's handbooks. We have... And we talked to them about the Committee of Safety and other things. You know, I'll post those. I don't think I've posted them, but I think I'll post those if we haven't already. We may have posted them. I'll have to take a look. Let me see if we did. It was probably on this page. Well, we have Sheriff Darr's letter posted here, so you can read that. Okay. But underneath here, I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to post also a copy of the letter that National Liberty Alliance wrote and also the imprint. It's a big shipping label that we wrote a couple of paragraphs on, talking about this book and the purpose of the book, and that is to remain the property of the sheriff's office so that sheriff to sheriff, next sheriff comes in, can get it. So I think we're having good response to this, but we need to get more books out. You know, we've got 10,000 members, and we've only got 300 books out, and I think we can do better. So let's try to do better, especially those people who have money. If you can afford to throw a thousand or two or so and buy your entire state, we will be safe, much more safer. Because remember, the sheriff right now can stop a whole bunch of things going on. You can go see your sheriff when you have a problem, when the feds come in to give you a hassle, when they come to take your property away from the non-judicial foreclosures, and the sheriff is educated in the non-judicial foreclosure procedure and process and why. It's in the book. All this stuff is in the book. And, you know, then that sheriff can step up and say, hey, this ain't going to happen. And remember, they can't take a thing away from you without using the sheriff. And that's why they play that game, a notice of lien, particularly the feds, that is, through the IRS. They'll play that notice of lien game with you. When no lien has been filed. Believe me, I caught them on myself on two, three different cases already. No lien has been filed. Because in order for them to file that lien, it's a sworn affidavit. They have to swear to what they're saying and the amounts involved, and they have to give proof and lay it out before they can do that. And they cannot do that. First of all, USC 26 is not law, and it says so right in the law. Also, if you go down the rabbit holes that they give you all of these different information, you know, they'll tell you, well, this code, that code requires this, and you have to pay taxes for that. Well, when you start falling down that rabbit hole, going down, you find out it has nothing to do with you. It has to do with farming equipment and fuel on a farm or storage or transportation of fuel. And it has nothing to do with anything that we, the people, have. So they have nothing. But you're not going to be able to defeat these people very easily. I mean, you can if you have the knowledge of all this stuff and you bring it into court and you put the judge on really put it on the judge's back that, hey, you know, makes it clear, you know, that they're breaking the law and it's not there. The sheriff shuts it down and you go. That's right. The sheriff will shut it down and you don't even have to go to court. We got to get our sheriffs educated, people. We have to do this. We must do it. And we must get ourselves educated. But go ahead. Any other questions, thoughts, comments? And how do you pronounce your name, by the way?
Chitali.
Chitali. Okay. Go ahead, Chitali.
Yes. I did have another question. Sure. When you were reading a pamphlet, you talked about it mentioned the attorney, and some of the process which made me think that there was a little bit of commercial and common law mixed together in the pamphlet, or why was the attorney mentioned?
Well,
we are common law, and we're the people we're supposed to represent ourselves, right?
Yeah, well, maybe the word attorney is not a proper word to use. Definitely lawyer would have been better. Maybe we'll go back and change that word to lawyer. And I got to think about that a little more, because I think you're right with the word attorney. Remember, there are common law lawyers to begin with. And a lawyer educated in equity, which is what most lawyers are educated in, unfortunately, a lot of bad equity there. And that's what takes the sheriff to shut that down, because if they try to enforce bad equity, the sheriff can shut it down right there and then before it goes anywhere. The people just have to know that they can go to the sheriff, have some basic understanding of this, and the sheriff has to have the knowledge of it. And when you have that working together, you are then protected from an overreaching government. Lawyers are needed, especially in equity, okay? And we need people who are educated in equity. You know, you take President Trump when he was in the White House, you know, he had lawyers working for him, so he could understand what his powers and authorities were. And I think it's USC 3, maybe. I'm not too sure. Or 5, somewhere in there, which deals with the powers and the authorities of the sheriff. You know, all of these different codes deal with, one form or another, either some agency could be dealing with the court, the power of the judiciary, could be dealing with the legislators, could be dealing with the president, could be dealing with the CIA, the FBI, could be dealing with the Justice Department. You know, all these agencies, okay, each one of them have their own code that they have to operate by, okay? And then, of course, when you go to the law has nothing to do with equity. And judges have no power or authority to rule in a court of law, okay? People can decide to go before a judge in a civil court, if it's over $20, they can decide to have a court of record, and that's it. They go to a court of record where the people decide and not a judge. But if it's under $20, or even if it's over $20 and the people feel that they'll get a just decision from the court, where there is an appellate process to that, so that's kind of a safety net. But nevertheless, you can go to a judge and have the judge do it, and the case would go a lot quicker. You know, a lot of if you have a contractor, I'd be in a contractor, for instance, I may have a contract dispute that has to be settled in court, let's say, and it'll go very quickly before a judge. It could be put together very quickly. You can go in there and get it done in a couple hours, and you're out of there, and it's done, the case is over. But if we don't have just judges, we don't want to do that, of course. But that option is there. That's where a judge can make a judgment in a court, okay? And I guess we'll call it a court of law when we're giving them the authority to do so in a civil case. All equity cases must be tried by a judge. Magistrates, the purpose of magistrates, and all judges are magistrates, by the way, but the purpose of a magistrate mainly is to preside in a court of law as a traffic cop, kind of keeping things going, making sure things are properly moving along. But they cannot make any decisions. They can't interpret the law. They can't, say anything really to the jury beyond really giving the oath and making sure that things run smoothly. The other thing is U.S. attorneys have no power or authority to go talk to a grand jury. That is the job of the sheriff in the county. If an attorney has, a prosecutor has something they want to bring against people and to bring them, and I don't know if we mentioned that in this, and if not, maybe we'll put it in there. But the prosecutor has to go to the sheriff and give the evidence to the sheriff, and the sheriff, or whoever he puts out, doesn't have to be the sheriff himself, it could be one of his lieutenants or someone, they would go in and produce the evidence if they felt, this looks like something we should do. And they would produce the evidence to the jury. The coroner can go in and produce the evidence to the jury. And the people can go and give evidence to the jury. They can get a hearing with the jury and bring up a concern. I mean, but first, of course, people really should be going through the sheriff. And then, of course, that opportunity for the people, I think, is what's lawful, because this is who we are. And we need to protect the people as jurists, and we need to be, we are the people, you know. And the people make the law, we decide the law. We negate anything that the other, you know, that the government might bring up and say, hey, this, that, or the other thing. We can negate it all, say, forget about it, get out of here. So they have to lay their request at the feet of the jury, and the jury makes the decision to indict or not to indict. But no jury should be violated by a prosecutor.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I'm going to look back at the word attorney, and I'm just going to be safe and turn it to lawyer, you know, because I think there's so much
okay.
better.
Yeah. I did have one more question. Gosh, it kind of escaped me, but I was thinking that when you do an appeal, if you're using common law,
there is no appeal.
Right. So, okay, so in the pamphlet, it also talks about that process, too. So it's like, okay, so how do you appeal?
When a trial jury makes a decision, it's final. That's it.
Yes.
There is no appeal to that process. In courts of equity, okay, or contract court, in civil court that is under law, okay, it's a contract, maybe, you know, I mean, I do work under contracts, you know. So that contract rules of the court, and I can utilize a judge instead of utilizing a jury. Like I said, it could be a lot quicker. I would never do that right now because they're all crooked, the criminals. But in any event, you know, once you go through that process and the judge makes a decision and you don't like that decision, there's an appellate process. You can appeal it, and there's two or three appeals you can take, go up the line with. Now, in a court of record, when the jury makes a decision, it's over. Done. No appeal. It's done.
That's right.
It's like arbitration. I don't know if you're familiar with arbitration. And
I've been trying to study it a little bit.
Yeah. Arbitration, you know, like being in the construction business, for instance, usually we get an architect or an engineer to be an arbitrator. They have professional arbitrators, and I was under one of them before, but that was a disaster. You know, the guy wanted to be fair. We had to get what was good. A lot of money was involved. And I lost a lot of money because he wanted to split the thing and all that other crap, you know, where the other side was dead wrong. Otherwise, I wouldn't even have been in the process. Mm-hmm. But I've been in a lot of arbitrations where, an architect or an engineer was the judge in that case. And there is no appeal from an arbitration. And when a judge is an architect or an engineer, they have the knowledge of the business I'm in. And therefore, they see and they can judge rightly. So you have to be careful if you go into arbitration to make sure whatever the subject matter is that you're arguing and fighting about, that you have an individual that understands that process. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that's an important thing for people. It's a little tidbit people should realize if they use that system.
That's a huge tidbit.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Right.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And here we go. We've got two other people in the queue, and then we'll be moving on. Let's go to Ross. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Means I have to institute the jury in the my county.
What about your county? You want to what? Institute?
The common law jury, yes.
Yep. Well, the common law jury, you know, we have one going on right now, we're calling it Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury to deal with enemies, both foreign and domestic. And we have been doing indictments, and as a grand jury, we have brought one case into the courts. Actually, we brought two cases into the courts. And, of course, they're working hard to violate the case and to hijack it and bring us into, jurisdictions unknown. So it's a big battle right now, and we're mainly doing it in order to build more evidence to show the case itself becomes the evidence in the future. That's the key for what we're doing here. And at some point in time when we get to the other side meaning that the arrests have taken place, all these judges have been removed that are, which are probably most of them, and if not all of them, who knows. But, you know, once these judges are removed and all these people with the deep state are taken out, and this goes very deep right down into the state legislators and the governors, the state governors, and so on, and even further down into the county and even townships. So once that takes place and we bring back the weight and the law itself, the weight of the Constitution, that's when we can apply this. You know, we're not going to get anywhere in the courts, but we have to prepare now, we have to educate now, we have to write these things and get these things together, educate ourselves and our sheriffs, and get ready for that moment in time when we, the people, can finally take back our government and finally have government by consent.
Means also we have to institute the community safeties and not...
That's the only way.
That.
Yeah, look, I have come to the conclusion that the committees of safety is the key to our liberty. The committee of safety is the key to government by consent. The committee of safety is the key to working with the sheriff and local government and bringing the people together. And every time someone has a problem within that county, whatever town they're in within that county, and they have a problem, and someone says, hey, why don't you go talk to the committee of safety? Yeah, who are they? Where are they at? Well, they go down, they talk to the committee of safety, they explain their problem, and the committee of safety does, if it's a political situation, they can deal with it. If it's a law situation, they can pass it off over to the administration for the common law grand jury and the trial juries. And together the people could be working together, okay, in order to bring justice back into their courts, into their counties, and to get, to get these bureaucrats to obey the people, and opposed to we the people that they think have to obey them, okay? They give us a lot of pushback, a lot of problems. They create, you know, all these barriers to do things, and again, the Committee of Safety can deal with this problem. The Committee of Safety can become the committee man, and the active people in the towns, countywide, can come together and take control of 100% control of the political process. Once they collapse the deep state, there's going to be a big void even with the committee men. That whole system, I think, is going to collapse unless we were to enter into that. But why enter into that? Why get bothered into the statutory process of a system that was created? And I can't even find the history of where this thing was created. It clearly was not created before our Constitution, and it clearly was not created right after we came into being as a people, as the United States of America in 1789. So where did this come from, and why? And why the process? There are some processes in there, and I don't like at all. And it doesn't make any common sense, and therefore there's something wrong with it. So, again, the Committees of Safety is the key. And let me say for those people concerning the Committee of Safety, you can find that book under People's Duty in the handbooks, okay? And you come down here, you have the charter for the Committee of Safety, the Committee of Safety handbook, the Committee of Safety resolution, and the Committee of Safety vow. Anybody who wants to create a Committee of Safety, that's a point-by-point, step-by-step, blow-by-blow way of bringing it together, connecting with the sheriff, all of the things necessary to create a Committee of Safety and then execute the situations, the problems, and that you have in your towns and your county and your state together collectively with other counties, and with the federal government collectively with other states, we could deal with any problem. So the Committeeman Handbook is here. I'm going to go through that, and I think personally, I really believe I'm going to stop teaching anything on the Committeeman process, and let's give the power to the people right there, the active people, to go out and do what it has to do. Because just think about what the real power of the committeeman really is. And this is why they politically control the committeeman. The committeeman actually goes out and brings the people, puts the people onto the ballot. Anybody who wants to run for any office that affects that town or that county, but, within townships, when you fall into whatever the position of someone running for federal legislation, maybe as a senator. Well, senators should be chosen by the state legislature. The senators should be elected by the state legislature. That's according to
Section 3. Section 3 of the United States Constitution, Article 1.
Well, it wouldn't be Section 3, I don't think, because that's for the that's for the judiciary. Section 2 is for the president, so it would be in Section 1. And that's where you're right. There is another place. I think it's in Section 4 of the Constitution, which talks about the fact that they are not that the state is not to be. Forget the word that's used, but they have a right to the vote. Because right now, states have no right to vote on anything concerning the federal government's actions because they don't control the senators. Okay, but going back to
is Article 1, Section 3 of, and Clause 1 of that section.
Is that where it is? Okay. Do you want to read it?
Yeah.
Do I have it? Yeah, go ahead.
Just summarize it. It's basically saying the state's legislature has to choose a senator to represent the state.
There you go.
It means they appoint United States senator.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you have it. So it's up to that's where the state, right now the state is not sovereign. They have no say, no power, no authority because they don't control the Senate. The people, they have their representation, mm-hmm. you know, through those that we elect, okay? So we elect people to represent us, okay, as congressmen. And so the committee men get to decide who goes on to the ballot. Well, how do they decide who goes on to the ballot? They do that by petition. They get petitions signed. They got to get so many signatures within that particular election subdivision. If it's a, for instance, it could be an assemblyman for the state. It could be a congressman for the federal. So within that district, they got to get so many signatures. And if they get the right number of signatures, then they put them on the ballot. And so, therefore, they have to come to the group of people to request that because it's a lot of work for them to do it on their own. They have a lot of signatures. So we can put people into office, we can take them out through recall.
So right now, who's putting the power, the people who are putting the elected officials in those positions are the political bosses in the political party system right now.
Right. Well, yeah, right now, you know, it's, first of all, the committee men don't really, there's as much corruption, probably equal amount of corruption in the election process within the committee man process as there is in the election process as we're seeing right now with, you know, what's going on, elections for the president and others. We're seeing all the corruption and the control. Well, the committee man process is no different because, first of all, they choose only people, you know, the criminals on the right or the criminals on the left is what the people have to choose from. So they only choose criminals. Every once in a while, a good person does get by, but generally speaking, they only put criminals on the ballot. And they control the committee man process so strongly, they make them think that they're elected and they're not elected according to the process that's laid out. And so they're not really elected. And they control these people. And the vote is always counted in secret, or someone comes in with a group of votes and says, "Hey, I got all these votes from others that couldn't make it." I forget what they call that, but proxy votes, and that's all unlawful. Proxy votes have always been unlawful. But anyway, we could take it back. The Committee of Safety is the key to saving this nation. So I got to move on, Ross. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate the question. Mm-hmm. Thoughts. Okay, final person, Cody, and we'll move on to our next section here. Cody, you got the mic.
I wasn't going to ask too much, but he kind of primed my pump about the the senator right. there. You know,
yeah, that was the 17th Amendment that destroyed the Senate.
Well, they justified it because apparently there was a lot of corruption, supposedly.
There is no justification. They can't change the Constitution. That requires a constitutional convention. And there's a balance of power. Huh?
There's an amendment, I believe. Wasn't there?
They can't do it. No, not at all. First of all, the 16th and the 17th Amendment was never ratified. Okay, and I got a book, as a matter of fact, that lays out or shows all of the votes and everything. But nevertheless, it was unlawful because it changes the entire balance of the Constitution.
Yeah.
In order to
I agree. And the bigger issue with all of that is when the legislature was appointing a senator, they had the power of recall.
Exactly.
And now
at any time.
That if you vote for somebody, I mean, wouldn't we have the same power then for people to recall them back?
Absolutely. That's what the committeemen can do. That's exactly.
You don't now.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't matter what they say. We know that they're liars, and we know what the law is, and we know what our rights are, and we know what common sense is. If a person isn't doing the job, the people have every right to be able to say, let's get rid of this guy. We'll fire him. How are we going to fire him? We've got to get a certain amount of percentage of signatures equal, you know, percentage of what the voting that voted them into. Well, actually, for recall, I think there is a certain there is a formula. Okay,
there is no recall on the federal, from what I've courts have ruled on that.
Who cares? We don't act under equity. We act under a law, and law comes from the sovereign, and we're the sovereign. We make the law as we go. We don't want those people in power. The people come together and get them out. They did it to California recently. The people, without going through committeemen, did it in California with the governor. They recalled the governor. Okay? You're not going to... Once the
rule... It didn't rule pass, I thought.
Oh, no, they did went through that process. Oh, yeah, they got through that process. You can't negate it. You can't get rid of it because it's an unalienable right of the people to have government by consent. And if we're no longer consenting to someone who's a criminal in office or someone who is just ignoring the Constitution and destroying their office, we have every right to fire them. They don't have a right to stay there for any purpose if the people don't want them there. We just got to get enough people on the signatures of the petitions in order to accomplish the goal for removal and a recall the individual and go up for another vote to replace them.
To me, the big thing is the monetary system that, you know, when you can just print whatever money you want or just a journal entry in electronic, you know, books, is it gives you so much power to hire bureaucrats, and that's the issue. I ran
well, of
this
course,
idea
the
by...
Thing, but the thing here is this, okay? Again, the Constitution addresses this in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution.
Yeah, it's law.
Yeah, gold and silver is
John,
the only
thing. Let me share this idea. I ran it by Brent one day, so that's kind of an innovative way to do it. If he's on, he can comment. But about suing based on the Fifth Amendment taking clause that... When they're creating all this fiat currency, they're devaluing everybody's savings.
Exactly.
That's a taking. I don't know if anybody's ever made that argument. I'd be curious. I try
well,
to do some
yeah,
personal
look,
researches.
Anybody who is really looking into it and is really, you know, researching and really looking into these things, it's clear to us. And I've looked into it to a degree. It is clear to us what they've done. Look, I remember when money had power, and it didn't even have all its power, okay? Because when I was a child, a kid growing up, the dollar was worth about 70 cents, okay?
It takes $658 to equal $100 in 1971 when they came off the silver standard, gold standard.
Well, a dollar has a value of 2 cents, and if you work that ratio out, I'm sure maybe it's close to what you're saying, but it's got a value today of about 2 cents, 2 to 3 cents maybe, at the most. And but again, you know, I remember a pizza pie very clearly. My father or my mother sent me to the pizza store to pick up a pie for dinner or whatever, and a large pizza pie was $1.15. You know, a gallon of gas back then was 26, 27 cents a gallon, and that was in New York City, so it was probably even cheaper in other areas.
Change, you know, it'd be nice to be able to go buy a slice of pizza for a quarter or something and not have
to... Forget quarter, no, a slice of pizza when I was a child was 15 cents, but 15 you, cents, if you go back to what its true value it is, it's probably more like about 8 cents or 7 cents for a slice of pizza. Okay, because you got to go back to when they destroyed it back in 1913, 1916, and that area is when they destroyed it and they created the bank and so on and so, you know, the Federal Reserve started to destroy the whole process. But if you can, and I did a study on this, and I did put a paper up on this on our website, you can go back and see the value of a dollar that stayed the same for 100 years, all the way up until the early 1900s. Nothing had changed. A loaf of bread, a piece of meat, you know, a bottle of milk, a gallon of milk, all that. Gasoline, of course, when that came out, and you know, later on,
you got a,
oil.
Yeah, you got a
nothing
silver
had
can.
Changed.
Only way you're going to have inflation is somebody hits another mother load, you know.
Yeah. Well, look, that's why we got to go back. We have to go back to gold and silver. And there's no doubt in my mind that's where we're heading to. When things go back, Trump is a brilliant guy. He's still behind all this thing. And he's got the whole plan. He's already created an economy alongside this economy. He's already seized most of the gold that has been stolen from us. And when we put these people in jail, well, you've got to take the things that they own away from them and give it back to the rightful owner. And that is we, the people. Okay? So there are tremendous, you know, probably 80 or 90% of the economy they control as far as, you know, controlling the money, the properties, and, you know, all of the equity that's out there. You know, we take that all back. It comes back to the people. And that ultimately is a worldwide thing. Because once the United States will do it, all the other countries will.
I was even thinking about this. I was reading about, you know, the old farm, you know, when they, what do they call it? Recalled all the loans back on the farms and the, you know, during the Depression, all
mm-hmm.
on purpose to ruin the farmers. Like, I mean, we really need reparations for that. We need to like,
absolutely
track down all these banker criminals and all, you know, like.
For every injury, for every injury, there must, this is a common law maxim, for every injury, there must be a remedy. And when the people have been destroyed, look at, they've destroyed our farmland. I'm not even sure how we're going to fix that. They've taken all the minerals and destroyed. They depleted the minerals out of the soil. We're not getting the nutrition, the minerals that create that nutrition. We're not getting that out of our food that grows. We've got corporate farming. You got chickens. They've got them. The GMO chickens that instead of taking, and I may be wrong in the time period, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. You know, the normal from an egg to slaughter is 90 days. Well, they were through a GMO, genetically modified organisms, I guess, is all. But anyway, what they've done is they've changed that now to 45 days. So in half the time. Now, something's wrong with that chicken, okay? You've got a problem. And when you go and look at the chicken coops, a lot of these chickens can't even stand up. They're so fat, they can't even move, okay? They're crippled. So we got a problem with our food, and they're poisoning
absolutely.
Us in our water, in our food, in our air. I mean, these people are working on genocide, really bad. Our whole system really needs to be corrected. And I do believe once we get to the other side, these things will become corrected. I do believe that.
Yeah.
But only if we have government by consent. If we don't have government by consent, the only reason we won't have government by consent is because the people didn't step up to do what they had to do to take government by consent.
I can tell you a quick story. I don't know if Brent is on, but
yeah, he's in.
The county Brent is from, I called the sheriff and I said, you know, I think this is child abuse at all these schools. You guys are forcing these kids to wear a mask.
Absolutely.
There's a law in Illinois that says that, you know, that's a form of quarantine. A medical device is a form of quarantine. The health department can only quarantine and only up for two days without a judge's order. So all these schools are breaking actually statute law, and I couldn't get the deputy that I talked to. I said, you guys are supposed to be the chief law enforcement officers in this county, and there's child abuse going on. He says, what do you want me to do, go arrest the teachers or whatever? I said,
they need to be educated. That is the reason for a campaign for constitutional sheriffs, and I really hope everyone really takes this to heart, passes it out to people beyond this meeting. Pass it to people in your neighborhood, your friends, your neighbors, your family. You get them involved in this campaign for constitutional sheriffs, and let's get these books into the hands of every sheriff. We got 3,000 roughly sheriffs out there. We've got 3,134 counties, but every county doesn't have a sheriff. So we have about 3,000 sheriffs. And we need to get the book, and then we've got to get sheriffs in the counties that we don't have them. And we need to get these books into their hands so that they can become educated. We need to connect them.
They don't read it. They don't. You know, the problem is they have to have the desire.
Well, look, they do. They do. The sheriffs that I have spoken to, and I've spoken to quite a few, and other people I know have spoken to other sheriffs, and I'm telling you, they don't know what to do. They haven't been educated. They haven't been trained in common law and the way this process of this nation needs to go as far as the court process and system. They don't know it. And that's why we wrote the book, so that they could know it and the people could know it. And they are interested. They are, look, you're going to get that clown. Let's say 10% of them aren't. Fine. We're still going to take over and we're going to get rid of that 10% eventually, because the people in those counties are going to see they have a sheriff that's not doing his duty. Okay?
Yeah.
But it's up to us to do. It's up to us to get that education to them. It's up to us to get ourselves educated. It's up to us to prepare ourselves to take the government back once we can. Okay? It's up to us.
Yep. So, it's going to be tough. I tried to set up a committee of safety, and I made an announcement with a blowhorn at the school to have everybody send their, you know, their parents over the next night to a public monument and meet. Nobody showed up, so they don't.
All right, well, I got to move on. Anyway, and one of the person jumped in, and I'm going to be very short, was Michael. Looks like Michael from Michigan. It's going to be very short because I want to move on. We've got Brent that needs to take things on, and we've got Gerard's got a program. So, Michael from Michigan, real quick, what do you have?
Yes, good evening, John.
Good evening.
When you were talking about value of money, how can we talk about value of money when the corporational wing of the Federal Reserve is nothing but a group of bankers that that create worthless paper and submit it to our government for interest?
All of that is unlawful. When President Trump was president, the president he put up behind himself at his desk was Jackson. Jackson killed the bank. He killed the second bank. Okay, and he intends on killing the third. He's already set an economy alongside this economy. He's already brought the process in motion. Okay. And at some point in time, it's going to go over to that, and we got to get rid of. If we're going to become a lawful republic again and obey the Constitution, we have to have lawful money. Everything, we have to go back to the Constitution. We have to hold these people. We have to chain these people down with the chains of the Constitution, as Jefferson put it. Okay, and that's what we intend on doing, and that's what we the people can do if we are educated. And it doesn't take millions of people. Okay, it takes a handful of people. And again, I say 200 people in every county, roughly speaking, can control this entire nation easily. Okay, and I think 200 would be a low number, because once the people in the towns and within the counties start to realize what's going on and seeing the power and the authority and what kind of a government we really can have by participating and bringing their problems to the people who can solve them, they will join up. You know, and we will make the point to those people, freely you are being given, freely you have to give. Okay? So we'll give you freely whatever we can for you. And that's a biblical principle.
Just my last point, John. But sure. When you're talking about value, you said today's dollar, which is a fiat dollar, has a 2-cent value. I don't know how we can accredit a 2-cent value to a fiat worthless piece of paper.
Well, you're right in the sense that that piece of paper is really a debt, and whoever's holding the most at the end of the game is the biggest loser, okay, because it's worthless, all right? But right now you can trade that in, you know, to gold and silver. You can buy gold and silver with the fiat. They still allow that. And so you could do that, and you can have that value. But I'd done a paper on this. I was just looking for it. I don't remember where exactly it's at. But I wrote a paper, and it lays out the value of a dollar, and it looked at what money was and what things were bought at for the first 100 years of our nation, you know, through the 1800s, from 1779 all the way up until through the 1800s. And then looking when the Federal Reserve came into play, there was no inflation because we were using real money, okay? And then when the Federal Reserve came into play, all of a sudden, little by little, the inflation started to grow, okay? By the time the 1960s came, you know, in the 1950s, money was still pretty powerful, okay? Because people were building homes, you know, after World War II, they were building homes for $3,000, $4,000. You were able to build a home, okay? So just think about that. And now, when I was I'm conscious from the 60s because I was born in the 50s, but I was very conscious in the 60s as you know, being a child that can see certain things. Memories would really, not that I was involved politically or understood what was going on, but I remember things. I remember what it cost when my parents would give me 75 cents to go to the movies. I'd get into the movies. On a Saturday morning, we'd get there at I think it was 10 o'clock in the morning or something like that, or 9:30. you have all these cartoons, and there would always be two shows, and you'd be there till like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so you spend the whole day there. On 75 cents, you had your entrance, you had your soda, your popcorn, some candy, and still left the place with a nickel or a dime, okay, that you can use later on in the candy store when you're out playing stickball or something later on a Saturday, or whatever the case may be. I remember that. And you think about the power of 75 cents as a kid, and you can think about it today. What does it cost to go to a movie? I don't even know what it costs these days. 15, 20 bucks, probably 20 bucks. You know, I don't even know what it costs to go to a movie. So, in
conclusion, you're saying that the actual dollar is still connected to gold and silver, but it'll purchase very little gold and silver.
Yeah, it's not really connected. They have no choice, but also for their own purpose, they want to take all the fiat money they're stealing from us and purchase gold and silver. And so that's a process. But to some degree, they don't have much of a choice. But they're at a point, and they're so bold and evil, they could at some point say, hey, forget about it. You can't buy gold and silver for fiat dollars no more. It's over. And I wouldn't be surprised if they tried to do that. But look at
Red October
is coming. I don't know if you're paying attention to that, but Red October is right around the corner. What's it, next week? It's actually this week, right? Friday, I think, is the 1st, October 1st. We're moving into what Q called Red October, and things are moving along. So,
all right. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Okay, real quick, Jan, if we have any questions, maybe we'll hold them off till next week.
Yes, I have about four or five questions tonight, John.
Any you think is important to do now, or can we hold them till next week? Because I ran so long here.
Well, there's nothing that has a deadline for this week, no.
Okay, so let's do it for next week, and I can move along. Is there any announcements that need to be made?
Well, I did run across a really, really good documentation of 30 COVID facts that you need to know. It's the best compilation I've run across anywhere. I'd run into different items on it here and there and everywhere, but this is all put together in one little document. And I put a URL for it, the link in the newsletter, so if anybody wants to know an awful lot about COVID in a very easy way, go to the newsletter and click on the link, and you'll get it in a PDF form. Other than that, no, I don't have any particular announcements.
All right. I just want to make a couple of points to some things I've been seeing through the mail coming through. There are people who still haven't gotten their book yet. I think maybe four or five people. And I don't know why that hasn't gone out and that they haven't got it, and maybe they're off the list. But they write me an email through mail@nationallibertyalliance.org, which, you know, I see and all leadership sees. And one of the problems is I needed more information, okay? I need to know when you bought the book, and that'll help me to be able to look up the paperwork and also to know whether you bought the book through us here at National Liberty Alliance or through Dorrance, because right now Dorrance is buying the book. Also, well, I guess that's the key thing. I need to get information. I also need, like, a full name, and I need the date roughly when you bought the book, and I need to know. Back then, we didn't have any ID numbers. Right now, if you buy a book for a sheriff, it follows up through the number, you know, so it's recorded, and we have a record of it. But we do have a record of the paperwork. But the key thing, though, is getting, in case I can't find the paperwork and stuff, but as long as we can find it on the list, because I had some others put that list together, so either on that list or on the paperwork. If you didn't get a book, we'll send you one out. I know we need also your anybody who says they didn't get a book, I need your name, I need your phone number, and I need your mailing address. Those are the three main things, and the date you bought the book. And if I have any questions, I'll give you a call. If not, if I don't have any questions, I'm just going to mail the book out. But there's not that many. I think maybe about five people at this point, possibly six. So, again, send me that info. Otherwise, I can't do anything. Okay, with that, I'm going to... Gerard, are you with us tonight? I see you're in. Gerard? Hello, Gerard.
He's on the panel.
Yeah, I see him. Can you beep him or something over, and I'll try to move over to him. But right now I want to go over to Brent, and we'll try to get Gerard as we go forward. All right, we're going to move to Brent. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. He's a common law lawyer. His website is commonlawyer.com. And Brent, if you have any thoughts or corrections on the paper we looked at today, that would be appreciated also. You got the mic, Brent. I think you're muted, Brent, if you're talking. Let me see if I can unmute you. No, I can't. You got yourself muted, Brent. Brent.
Yeah, there we go.
Gerard, you here yet? Okay, Brent, you got the mic.
Okay, thank you. And this is Brent Allen Winters.
Just one other thing. After Brent is finished, we're going to go to an open forum. But go ahead.
Okay, thanks. This is Brent. Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And this is my comments, nobody else's, just mine. It does not necessarily mean anybody else that's in position of leadership, but National Liberty Alliance agrees, but we do pretty often, I found. Let me get straight to something here I've been revisiting. It doesn't hurt to go back and revisit again and again and again. And that is the subject of the jury. Need more volume, says Terry. Wow, Terry. Let me try this. Terry, tell me, is this better? I'm using a different mic, so send me a message real quick so I know. If it isn't, I'm plugging back in again.
No, that's
worse. No, it's
worse,
so.
Yeah. No, I think you're okay.
Now I'll just keep doing the best I can.
Yeah, I raise my volume, and you're good coming through. People can raise their volume if they can't hear you. But I haven't really raised my volume on you. Yeah, you're good.
Okay. I've got two messages from concerned persons saying I'm doing okay as long as I stay close to the mic. Okay, this is the subject is the jury. I got a request the other day. Somebody was coming from South Africa to speak at a conference. And he couldn't make it because they told him if he got on an airplane in South Africa, in Pretoria, they were not going to let him on unless he took the jab to come to America. So he's not coming. So they asked another fellow if he'd come. He couldn't come. And so then they called me. So I'm going to go talk. I'm the third choice. But I'm glad for it. But the subject is the weapons of the common law in the hands of the church militant. The weapons of the common law in the hands of the church militant. Now, if you've not heard that word before, that phrase before, church militant, that's a phrase that arose out of the Reformation. And they said that the church is not militant up in the skies. Those folks aren't fighting the battles up there, up in the heavens. Those that are with Jesus Christ aren't in the battle right now. But those folks of us down here were in different situations, so they called them the church militant because the world hates with a pink-purple passion, the disciples of Jesus Christ. I'm not giving you my opinion. I'm just telling you what Jesus Christ said. He said that. And then he unpacked it and explained it. You can go to the Gospel records and read it. But of all the weapons that our common law provides, only found in common law countries, of which there are only five major countries in the world, and as we often say, all the rest of the world is under the law of the city, or some form of the Code of Justinian, the canon civil laws of Rome, the law of Babylon, the law of the evil empires of this world, always fundamentally the same. But the common law countries have juries. They do. And America, more than any other common law country, uses the jury more than any other common law country, but not enough. But it's here. Now, about 3, 4, or 5 years ago, and then a year or two before that, there was a lady got on a Monday night call, National Liberty Alliance, and she tore into me. And it was over the question of authority. And she said she knew a lawyer that didn't agree with me. And I said, well, that's normal. That's what lawyers do. That's why they go to court and fight, because they disagree. So tell me something I don't know. She said, well, he knows more about it than you do. Well, he may know more about a lot of things than I do, but authority and power are two different things. They're two different things. And juries have not only authority, but they also have power. They have power, but they also have authority. And those are two different things, very much so. And then that made her mad. Then she came back later and tore into me and at another call and said, well, you got in trouble with the government. And of course, my response to that is, well, why aren't you in trouble with the government? Are you doing whatever they tell you? And are you carrying water for them and kissing their fanny and doing everything the evil empire tells you to do? Well, then you're not on my team, because if you are a follower of Jesus Christ, the useful idiots of the evil empire of this world will hate you, and they'll come after you. And as a lawyer, that's happened. Matter of fact, I talked to a lawyer that from St. Louis, Missouri, that had gone to law school where I'd gone, and he'd worked for the IRS when he got out of law school. A lot of lawyers get out of law school and they go to work for the government right away because they can't find a job. And so that's what they end up doing. Then they get acclimated to working for the evil empire, having their nose, as Justice Scalia used to say, having their nose swilling like a pig in the public trough, and they never get over it. I was hoping this guy got over it. I met him. He's from St. Louis, and he was an IRS criminal defense lawyer. He had been a prosecutor for the federal government, prosecuting tax cases in criminal court. And he confided in me. He was younger than I was, but he said, Brent, when I was working for the federal government, he was conservative. But he got a baptism when he went to work for the government of what a so-called conservative is. And he found out that a conservative in government, a Republican, the only difference between a Republican and a Democrat is that the Republican wants to go at a slower speed as we're headed for the cliff. The Democrat wants to go as fast as he can and just run over the cliff and die. The Republican just wants to go slower. Now, wait a minute. You're going too fast. Slow down a little bit. That's all it is. I went to hear this fella talk in 2006 in Phoenix, Arizona, a big conference there, and a well-known defense lawyer with a few other fellows I knew had put it on. His name was Victor. Victor, that was his first name. He's still in Arizona. Well-known defense lawyer. That's been a number of years ago. They invited a fellow to come and speak. Ron Paul was there, and I remember him being there. A few thousand people. It was a successful get-together. They had this fellow there. It used to be a Black Panther. I forget his name. Black Panther back in the 60s. And his name not important to the story. Well, before that, he'd run for U.S. Senate after he was a Black Panther. I think he ran for U.S. Senate in the 1990s. Well, they let him speak. He was a libertarian kind of a fellow, but I think he was more of a Christian man. His father had been a preacher. And the thing that I remember he said, and I like to quote other people, as some of you know, he who never quotes is never quoted, and that's one of my favorite quotes right there. But this fella said, and I'm going to quote him, see if I can get this straight. I'm going to take a stab at it. If I get it backwards or cattywampus, I'll come back and try to do it again. But he said, this former Black Panther leader in California, that's where he was from, he said that a Democrat, the definition of a Democrat is a man that does not, or a woman, that does not understand economics. He doesn't know how to do arithmetic. Doesn't understand economics. And a Republican is a man or woman who hasn't had their butt kicked by a cop. Yeah, that was it. A Democrat is a man who doesn't understand economics, but has had his butt kicked by a cop. And a Republican is a man that does understand economics, but hasn't had his butt kicked by a cop. Well, there's some truth in that. There is. And when it comes to the jury, I have fondness for the jury, because the jury sprang me. A stacked jury sprang me in a criminal case. So, and I was being prosecuted, like this fellow from St. Louis told me that he used to work for the IRS. He said when he was working for the IRS and John Ashcroft, who presents himself and has presented himself to the world as a Christian right-wing conservative. His father was founder of the flagship Bible College of the Assembly of God denomination in Springfield, Missouri, called Evangel. I went to law school, fellows from Evangel College. Ashcroft, graduate of University of Chicago Law School. Ivy League stuff. Attorney General of Missouri. Governor of Missouri. Senator of the United States Senate from Missouri, then Attorney General of the United States. But he had a policy that if there's any lawyer out there defending those accused of tax crimes in the federal courts, any lawyer, and if that lawyer makes less, according to his tax returns, makes less than $40,000 a year, and doesn't belong to a law firm, then it was the policy of Ashcroft when he was Attorney General to seek a grand jury indictment against him for conspiracy against the United States, conspiring with his client. And they looked at me and said, well, this guy fits in the category. He's defending people in federal court, tax crimes. He's representing people before grand juries. We've got to indict this guy. And so they set about to do it. And six grand juries later, they got the job done. Thank God for juries. Even a stacked jury at common law, even a stacked jury works. That's right. Why? Because it's not a majority rule institution. It's not a majority rule institution. The jury is an institution, all or nothing. It is arguably the chief weapon of our common law. No country has ever lost its freedoms entirely. Oh, they get a little few of them here and there, but no country has ever lost them as long as they've kept their jury, their grand jury and their petit jury. You say, well, there aren't that many common law countries in the world anyway. That's true. But if we ever lose our jury, we will lose our freedoms. Why? Because in our common law tradition, the jury is the final arbiter of right and wrong in individual instances from whose decision there is no appeal. That's Godhood, friends. You say, well, you don't believe in the Godhood of juries, do you? Well, no, not in the ultimate Godhood of juries, but remember what Jesus Christ said to the Pharisees of his day, the so-called religious fundamentalists. Remember what he said? He said, explain this to me. Why does David in the Psalms, my ancestor, by the way, not mine, but Jesus Christ speaking, it was his ancestor. Why does he say of the people, the militia, of the 12 several tribes of Israel, why does he say, ye, plural, are gods? Why does he say that? With a little g, by the way, gods. Well, it was a rhetorical question. The reason he said it is called the jury. The jury is the final decider of right and wrong in individual instances from whose decision there is no appeal down here on land. Oh, I know there's always an appeal to heaven. He is the final lawgiver in the universe. But the jurisdiction that God has given to men, God is the final lawgiver, the jurisdiction he has given to men is to be final deciders of right and wrong in individual instances from whose decision there is no appeal down here on land within this realm. That's what the jury does. It's so important. The jury is so important to our Maker that he decided, our Maker decided, to empanel 12 men. 12 men. As jurors, with two alternatives, two alternate jurors, by the way, and they're both named, just like we do today, when we empanel the jury, we empanel two alternates to set through the entire trial, just in case one of the 12 jurors goes belly up, gets sick, has to go home, dies, whatever. We have two alternates that set through the whole trial and hear all the evidence. Well, that's the way it was with Jesus Christ. There were two alternates. And when one of the jurors tried to hang himself, I say tried, the rope broke, over the edge of a cliff, and he fell headlong and hit so hard it busted his guts out. That's what the Bible says. That's Judas, the one who betrayed Jesus Christ. So they had to find another. You see, that was a stacked jury too. What a mess. But the jury still works. Why? Because God said so. That's why. It's arguably our chief weapon against tyranny in our common law tradition. Let me read here from the Supreme Court of the United States and here on National Liberty Alliance. I've been here a few years, and I've heard John and the others quote this case, talk about this case. I thought, well, it'd be a good idea that on Monday nights I just read this case, but can't get through the whole thing, but I'll read through it. But I don't want to read it all. Some of it is administrative, but I want to read the parts that are pertinent. Let me start here. We're starting on page, what page is this? I've got it labeled right. This is Justice Scalia writing. He said, rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history. Anglo-American history. Now remember, Scalia was not an Anglo. Scalia was of Italian descent. Scalia was of Italian descent. I think he was the son of an Italian immigrant. Maybe his granddad, I don't remember. But he wasn't an Anglo. But Scalia was by culture an Anglo. By culture, not by blood. And those that come to America, regardless who they are, they come into an Anglo-American culture. What is the Anglo-American culture? It is our common law culture. It's not just for the Anglos. It's for all men to come. to be a part of what God has designed for men, regardless of whether or not they're Anglos. But we call it Anglo-American because our roots are in Britain. That's why it's called that. And Justice Scalia is making that point. Rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history, the grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights. Now, don't think that these justices are all that smart. I like some of them. But one thing that irks me to the point that I almost explode with rage is statements like I just read here. The grand jury is mentioned in the Bill of Rights. Why don't they say this instead? The Bill of Rights mentioned the grand jury. Why do they put it in the passive? Passive. Lawyers are terrible about that, even when they're right-headed, like Justice Scalia. Well, let's go on. It's not in the body of our Constitution. It's just mentioned, it says, in the Bill of Rights. That's the 10 amendments, the first 10 amendments to our Constitution, way back in the earliest of days, right after our Constitution was ratified, the ratification of our Constitution. But not in the body of the Constitution, the grand jury is mentioned. It has not been textually assigned, therefore, to any of the branches described in the first three articles. Remember, the first three articles of our Constitution of the United States, the first article, this is the greatest part of our Constitution, the first article unpacks the meaning and the job of the Congress of the United States. The second article unpacks the meaning and the job of the President of the United States. And the third article unpacks and describes the meaning and the job of the Supreme Court of the United States. The first article establishes the Congress of the United States. The second article establishes the presidency of the United States. And the third article establishes the Supreme Court of the United States. The three branches of government, they're all right there, co-equal, separate. Neither one of them rules any of the others. Well, the grand jury is a constitutional fixture in its own right, says the court. The court continues, in fact, the whole theory of its function is that it belongs to no branch. Remember, there are three branches. No branch of the institutional government, serving as a kind of buffer or referee between the government and the people. Between the government and the people. Justice Scalia said elsewhere, back in the year 2004, in a case that altered the course of a federal case, criminal case I was arguing at that time, he said that the jury is the only thing that stands between the accused and a lone employee of the state. The only thing, the jury is the only thing that stands between the accused and a lone employee of the state. God, the ultimate lawgiver, from whose decision there is no appeal in individual instances. That's the definition of a lawgiver. We say God's, with a little g for the jury, a big G for the maker of all things. That's what the Bible says. And that's the jurisdiction that God has given to men when they're impaneled. 12 of them on the jury. They get to decide. You know, the rest of the world says we're crazy. Why would you turn over to 12 men on a jury? They're just guys you grab off the street. They just happen to be standing around. They get grabbed up, put on a jury, and in a murder case, they decide who's guilty and who lives and who dies. Then they decide whether or not you get the death penalty. In France and South America and China and Russia, all over the world, they say you folks, you Americans, are crazy. You need to turn those kind of decisions over to the experts. That's what they say. G.K. Chesterton. G.K. Chesterton was the curator, some kind of a fancy museum in Australia. And he went to jury duty in Australia. Common law country, you see. Well, when he got out, he wrote about his experiences, put in a little essay. It was called Something Trifles. Big Trifles, or it was kind of an oxymoron title. But he said, it's odd. It's odd. Why do we impanel juries? He said, well, because the judge and the lawyers and the sheriffs and the bailiffs and the police, all the experts on the law, they're just too used to it. They're too used to it. They could not have felt what I felt sitting in the jury box because they're too used to it. They're hardened to it. It's just another day at the office for them to hear those kind of things. It wasn't for me, he said. He said, in a common law country, even in a common law country, he was in Australia, he said, if we want to catalog a library, we find the expert on the subject to catalog the library. If we want to discover another galaxy, well, we look for the experts on the subject, the astronomers. If we want to discover another element to the periodic table, we seek out the experts, the chemists, on the subject. But if we want to decide who lives and dies in a murder case, we just grab 12 men standing around and ask them. But then he said, as a passing statement, he said, but if I'm not mistaken, that's what Jesus Christ did. He just grabbed 12 men standing around and said, I want you to be witnesses to the identity, my identity. And remember, he asked Peter, he said, who do men say that I am? Peter. He was one of the three insiders of the 12. You know, there were 12. Then there was a foreman, that was John. He's the only one that didn't get murdered for his verdict. And none of them changed their verdict, by the way. They were all murdered except one. But Peter was the most mouthy. He was the mouthiest one of the 12. It's amazing to read the gospel records and see the personalities of these men shine through. Peter getting nervous. And when he got nervous, he'd shoot off the mouth and say the dumbest things. You know, he's the one that denied Jesus Christ before the cock crew, before the rooster crowed in the morning. Jesus Christ said, you'll deny me three times. He said, oh, never, Lord, I would never deny you. And right after he did so, because he was scared out of his wits, the cock crew. That's one of those kind of phrases sticks in your head from childhood. People don't talk like that anymore. They'd say the rooster crowed. But in the old English, they say the cock crew. And then it struck him what Jesus Christ had said. And it says he broke down and wept. Big, tough fisherman Peter. Well, at any rate, they all got impaneled. They didn't change their verdict. Thankful for that. But God established the jury, and we use the jury, just 12 sinners, like the 12 disciples, just us. And God has ordained us to be final deciders of right and wrong in individual instances from whose decision there is no appeal, from non-criminal cases such as a contract case or a tort case to criminal prosecutions, such as a murder case. All of them. Sorry, Job. Well, let me read a little longer here. This is good. A constitutional fixture. In fact, the whole theory of its function, that is the jury, the grand jury, is that it belongs to no branch of institutional government, although the grand jury normally operates, of course, in the courthouse and under judicial auspices. Its institutional relationship with the judicial branch has traditionally been, so to speak, at arm's length. Judges' direct involvement in the functioning of the grand jury has generally been confined to the constitutive one of calling the grand jurors together and administering their oaths of office. The grand jury's, this is the Supreme Court, I'm reading what the Supreme Court said about the grand jury. The grand jury's functional independence from the judicial branch is evident both in the scope of its power to investigate criminal wrongdoing and in the manner in which that power is exercised. Unlike a court, whose jurisdiction is predicated upon a specific case or controversy, the grand jury can investigate merely on suspicion that the law is being violated, or even because it wants assurance that it is not. By the way, the rules of evidence, the common law rules of evidence that we are so persnickety about during a criminal trial, lawyers fight, and they ought to, over how those rules apply. Objection, Your Honor. Speculative. Objection, Your Honor. Ask and answered. Objection, Your Honor. Badgering the witness. Objection, Your Honor. Hearsay. That's all a matter of evidence. What evidence is going to be allowed in front of the jury? And with the grand jury, there are no rules of evidence. The grand jury can look at anything they want to look at. And as he says here, sometimes the grand jury, all they want to know, they don't need probable cause, they don't need a reasonable suspicion. They don't even need a hunch. They can investigate anything they want. Sometimes, he says, just to assure themselves that no crime is being committed. That's fascinating. It need not identify the offender it suspects, or even the precise nature. Oh, I see what they did. They slammed two words together accidentally in the text I'm reading. The precise nature of the offense. It is investigating. The grand jury requires no authorization from its constituting court to initiate an investigation. Did you hear that? The grand jury requires no authorization from its constituting court to initiate an investigation. You see, that's what happens. That's what happens when a grand jury becomes a runaway grand jury. A runaway grand jury. That's when the prosecutor is trying to get them to indict somebody, and they say, you know, we've changed directions. We think it's time to investigate you, Mr. Prosecutor. We're fed up with your gas. We want you to bring all your records in here, all the records of your personal life, all the records of your financial transactions, and we want to see if you're crooked. We just want to investigate to assure ourselves that you're clean enough to be trying to prosecute this case. But they can do that if they want, and in the history of our country, there have been times when runaway grand juries became pandemic, and prosecutors got tired of it, and they quit trying to prosecute cases in enforcement of, for instance, prohibition. They just quit because the grand juries got tired of it. They started investigating the prosecutors. So the prosecutor said, oh, okay, I get it. I'm backing off. They never see the light till they feel the heat, as Dirksen used to say. Well, and in its day-to-day functioning, that's the grand jury generally operates without the interference of a presiding judge. It swears in its own witnesses. It deliberates in total secrecy. True, the grand jury cannot compel the appearance of a witness and the production of evidence and must appeal to the court when such compulsion is required. Now, here's where the court enters in to the grand jury scene. The court, at the request of the grand jury, can hold somebody in contempt for not producing evidence before the grand jury if the grand jury makes such a request. No question. And the court will refuse to lend its assistance when the compulsion the grand jury seeks would override rights accorded by the Constitution. Accorded by the Constitution. See, why don't they say would override rights the Constitution accords? Why wouldn't they put it in the passive? I'm just throwing something out for free here because this is something that means a lot to me. You want to write powerfully, don't write in the passive. Write in the active. Write in the active. Oh, that's a quote, by the way. A quote. That's a quote from E.B. White. E.B. White, the author of Charlotte's Web and a whole lot of other stuff. Grand jury subpoena effectively qualified by order limiting questions so as to preserve speech. Oh, I see. Or even testimonial privileges recognized by the common law. There's another one. It should say even common law testimonial privileges the common law recognizes. Always backwards. Let's see. Even in this setting, however, we have insisted. We? Yes, all the justices in the past upon the United States Supreme Court. They don't have a mouse in their pocket, and they're not pregnant. They're just saying we to talk about all the justices that have ruled before have insisted that the grand jury remain free to pursue its investigations unhindered by the external influence or supervision, so long as it does not trench upon the legitimate rights of any witness called before it. Well, there's another one. Why didn't it say of any witness it calls? Well, recognizing this tradition of independence, we have said that the Fifth Amendment's constitutional guarantee presupposes an investigative body acting independently of either prosecuting attorney or judge. Acting independently of either prosecuting attorney or judge, if you ever get called to grand jury duty, do not be a rubber stamp for the prosecutor. No, when he, she, it, whatever they got up there today, tries to take over, you say, no. You just back off. And by the way, get your carcass out of the grand jury room. We want to talk about you for a while. Put the fear of God in them. It's your chance. It's your chance to put the fear of God in the prosecutor. Operate secretly without him. If you want something from him, send somebody else. Say, bring that punk in here. We want to talk to him. We want to ask him to bring us something, some evidence. We want this or we want that. Maybe about his target of an investigation or maybe about him. Don't let him tell you what to do. I have read. See, I, as a lawyer, I'm not allowed in the grand jury room. I've never been in the grand jury room except to testify. I did go and testify when they were trying to indict me. I did do that. But when I've had clients, and I've had about 36 clients before the grand jury, and I'll go with them to the grand jury room, but I don't go in the grand jury room. And if they have a question, when the grand jury asks them a question, they come out and ask me, what do I do? Do I take the Fifth Amendment? Or whatever they want to ask. Oh, it's shaky experience to be in front of a grand jury. How do I know? I've been in front of a grand jury. It's shaky. They have power, of course. Well, I'm glad they have power and not somebody else. No doubt, in view of the grand jury proceeding status as other than a constituent element of criminal prosecution. We have said, us and the former Supreme Court justices that have served before us, we have said that certain constitutional protections afforded defendants in criminal proceedings have no application before that body. Did you hear what I just said? Listen close again. This is huge. This is top drawer knowledge that folk ought to know. We have said that certain constitutional protections afforded defendants in criminal proceedings have no application before the grand jury. That means grand jurymen have tremendous power. And you're more naked and open there than you are in a criminal trial. The double jeopardy clause of the Fifth Amendment does not bar a grand jury from returning an indictment when a prior grand jury has refused to do so. Now, this, friends, neighbors, and kin, in my humbled and studied opinion, is wrong. Like I said, there were six grand juries impaneled before they got me indicted. And they would have kept impaneling grand juries up into unknown numbers until they got one stacked the way they wanted it. And they were stacking them. They generally always do. Don't kid yourself. But as I said before, that's the beauty of the jury. The jury is there because of the sinfulness, the evil of the heart of man. Power doesn't corrupt men. No, no. The weakness and the taint of wrongdoing is already there. The power just exacerbates it, pumps it up, fires it up, and there it goes. That's why the jury is so important, because God designed the jury. And he designed it in such a way that it works his will. You say in every case? Well, that's an important question. I just know this, there is nothing that has ever been devised among men for their use that has, for as little investment of money and time, produced as much freedom as our juries have produced. Now, I'm amazed how the juries get it right. And I'm also amazed how they get it wrong. It cuts both ways. But I know this, I don't want some lone employee of the state, some political hack called a judge in a federal court to decide my fate. And if that had been the case in my case, I'd have been put away for 9 years. And he proved it. He proved it. His hatred, his viciousness. Why? Well, he didn't want the IRS to audit him either. You see, everybody's afraid of the IRS in a criminal tax case. Even the jurors can be afraid. The judges aren't afraid. Their brain's not working, because they'll come after them too and send them to jail, and they've done it. Judges that didn't do their bidding. We have twice suggested, though not held, that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel does not attach when an individual is summoned to appear before a grand jury. Are you listening? Constitutional rights don't even attach always when summoned to appear before a grand jury. Now, some of them do. It depends upon the circumstances, and there are very important reasons for this, and if you want to read about them, you can read the cases. There are hundreds of cases that unpack and explain why all this is true, and when you read it and concentrate on it, in most cases you'll say, yeah, I get it. I understand why that's true with a grand jury. The grand jury is very special. Well, I'm going to get to the end of this paragraph and I'll quit. And although the grand jury may not force a witness to answer questions in violation of the Fifth Amendment's constitutional guarantee against self-incrimination, our cases do suggest that an indictment obtained through the use of evidence previously obtained in violation of the privilege against self-incrimination is nevertheless valid. Bottom line. To sum up, the common law rules of evidence that we are so jealous for in and during a criminal trial do not apply to the grand jury. Hearsay evidence, they can hear all of it they want. Anything they have access to, they can ask for. Relevancy isn't one of the requirements, as it is in trial before the jury. Because the grand jury, they get to decide what's relevant, not the judge. See the difference? The grand jurors are not lawyers. They're not lawyers. There's nobody to fight about the rules of evidence in front of the grand jury. The judge has no power over such things because the grand jury is not subject to the court. They are, remember, we said in the beginning, they're separate from the court. They can do as they blasted well please. Consider, for instance, when there are hearings before the Congress, the Senate of the United States, to appoint federal judges or Supreme Court justices, people are appalled by what goes on there. And they say, what about the rules of evidence? Well, here's the answer to that question. The rules of evidence don't apply in Congress. They can do any blasted thing they want. They can listen to anything they want. They can fight and fuss and make a sideshow out of it, which they usually do. Why? Because they're not subject to the courts. They're a separate and co-equal branch of government. They do as they blame well please. They're absolutely sovereign in their own jurisdiction. That's the point. And that is the point of the grand jury as well. They are sovereign in their own jurisdiction. They're not subject to the constraints. They're not subject to the constraints of the court. Well, this is Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And this ends my comments concerning the grand jury. Thanks a lot for letting me say a few words. And I'll turn it back over to Gerard if he found the button.
There's the button.
There's the button. Oh, thank you, Gerard.
Just think of how fast this country could straighten itself out with just that information, Brent. If the average person knew...
And that's what I... It's stabbing.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, between... Yeah. Look, not only do you have the grand jury, but then you get a second shot with the jury. And I never forgot that case with the ranchers out there. They had this jury stack. They even had a secret BLM person on the jury, and still they found them innocent because they ticked the jury off. The jury saw through all the baloney that was going on, and they said innocent. That was wonderful. I didn't think they would ever get a good ruling, but they did. As much as they tried to play backdoor games and stuff, they came out with the right decision. So,
And then they tased the defense lawyer in the courtroom.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I remember. Ridiculous, right?
Yeah, we're laughing, but because we don't know what else to do. But yeah, that's how far. But in the midst of the madness of the power, the out of control power of government and U.S. Marshals, those fellows ought to be ashamed of themselves. They ought to quit their jobs and confess their evil. I don't care what orders they got. That's unlawful to do, and they had a responsibility to not tase a lawyer in the courtroom. And can you imagine the chill that puts on lawyers?
Chill
it puts on them when they consider going in to defend somebody in federal court? Believe me, it does, and it has. Those things have a serious effect. So that's the kind of viciousness we're up against right now as we speak.
Did he ever go after them? He had... They were a little afraid of him. He had his own practice with a bunch of lawyers. That's what it takes to go after these guys. You can't do it alone, you know.
That's right, and they know that, and that's why I made that point a while ago. Lawyers, according to the policy of John Ashcroft when he was Attorney General, if a criminal defense lawyer in federal court made less than $40,000 a year, according to his tax returns, and he was not a member of a law firm, that way, see, if you're not a member of a law firm, you don't have any buddies to defend you, then his policy was to indict them. And he did. Now, this is the conservative, the Republican, the so-called Christian man, and all that baloney.
All right, well, I'm going to take, we got one person in the queue, we got a couple of minutes left, so I'll take that one person.
Okay, hey, this is Cody. Hey, Brent, during the when the Constitution was drafted, what was the intention? Was, if you were indicted, was that considered double jeopardy? It's, or to face a grand jury. It seems like that's the start of the trial process, so it seems like that double jeopardy should apply if the case, you know, if all facts are the same.
Well, if you're not to be tried for the same crime twice, there's a lot of detailed rules that go to that. For example, does double jeopardy apply before the jury is impaneled, or does it apply once the jury is impaneled? That's an important question, the double jeopardy. But what a grand jury does is not jeopardy. A grand jury only says yes or no. That's all they do. Yes, you may try this man for a crime and take his life, liberty, property, or combination thereof, or no, you may not. If people would just get that fundamental in their head, the simplicity of either say yes or no, and then at trial, then it's yes or no. You may take this man's life, liberty, property, or combination thereof, or you may not. That's what a jury does. But the standard, one more thing, Cody. Yeah. One more thing. Was that Cody or was that Gerard?
It's Cody. Yeah.
Cody?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Anyway, Cody, one more thing I want to mention, then I'll let you shut up and let you talk. The standard for indictment is more likely than not, this man is guilty of a crime. But the standard at trial is beyond a reasonable doubt. So you can get indicted. I was indicted, but I wasn't convicted. So there's a different standard. Go ahead, Cody.
It just seems problematic to me that they would be allowed, you know, to have six bites at the apple. It seems like that would not have been the intention, you know, the country was founded.
Oh, that with the grand jury? No, I get it. No, that's right, Cody. I don't believe that either. When it comes six bites of the apple, there's no end to it.
There's
got to be an end at law. This is what Henry Hyde. See, they had the Hyde Commission, as they called it back in the 90s. I think it was the 90s. It could have been the 80s, but it was back there somewhere. Henry Hyde, congressman from Illinois, and he was the head of the Judiciary Committee, and he headed up the Hyde Commission because the complaints were clear that, and he said this himself, a prosecutor, a U.S. prosecutor with a grand jury could indict a ham sandwich.
Yeah.
And because the grand jurors are ignorant and they're rubber stamping everything that happens, and they trust the prosecutor. And I've read the transcripts of grand jury proceedings. I read one where the guy that was the most mouthy, the mouthiest guy, he liked Peter the Apostle in the grand jury. He said to the prosecutor, "Hey, whatever you think, we're here to help you get done what you got to get done." That's what he said. Now that's typical of a grand jury. Yeah. And you know there are a lot of other guys like that, and they think they're being good patriots and conservatives talking that way, I guess, and thinking that way, because they're ignorant of the evil of the heart of man, what men will do when they have power.
Well, that must have been a pretty incompetent prosecutor that he had to take six swipes to get you indicted, no?
Well, in fact, yeah, and that prosecutor career was ruined over that whole situation.
Well, that's a good thing.
Prosecutor like that. Yeah, that's a good thing, but it was ruined because it took a long time to get the indictment. Then once got the indictment, didn't get the conviction. See,
right. So it was an empty victory.
Yeah, that was. But that's not unusual. Go ahead. What's that?
No, I didn't say anything.
That was Gerard just saying.
Did I lose you, Gerard?
No, I'm here.
Maybe everybody lost me. Oh, there you are. Okay.
Let me ask one last thing. So is there any historical precedent to where that was more limited? What did they pervert, Brent, to be able to get six bites of the apple? Is there something in our law that's changed? Is the forefathers really intend for that to happen, just forgot to put it in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights?
No. Remember, the Constitution doesn't explain anything. It explains nothing. It just throws stuff out there.
Yeah.
And the reason it doesn't explain anything, because it is a brief. Obviously, it's not that long. It's just a brief of the standards of common law government.
It doesn't explain, it mentions a dollar. It doesn't even come close to explain what a dollar is. It says trial by jury. Well, there's a whole, you could write volumes on trial by jury at common law, but it didn't do that. And that's true of all of the things it mentions. Separation of powers, the word separation of powers aren't even in our Constitution, but clearly it's part of our common law tradition. Our common law informs our Constitution at every phrase and every word. And without our common law informing our Constitution is an utterly dry.
I'm losing you there a little bit. He said it was utterly dry to be reading.
It's those things that people say, like Sam Clemens said, it's that kind of a thing that everybody says you ought to read, but nobody's ever read. Why don't people read the Constitution? I'll tell you why. That's an easy answer. Because it's dry. It doesn't explain anything. It doesn't tell you a story. It's just boom, 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 boom. I mean, the Declaration of 76. Now, there's some excitement there because you're reading the story a little bit. There's a story. You can follow the line a little bit and all the ugly things that the king and the parliament were doing. But in the Constitution, it's dry doctrine. But it is a brief of, as Supreme Court Justice Taft said, in compact draft. A brief of common law government in compact draft. Explains nothing. So when you say, well, why didn't the founders put that in there? Well, they didn't have to. They didn't put anything in there. They just said the words, and they knew the words, grand jury, freight centuries of custom. That's what our common law is. It is the thread of custom. We talk about Anglo-American law. Anglo-American law. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of just the way we do things. And a lot of it not written down, but we remember it. We read about it here and there. In cases, we begin to put it together. Oh, I see the thread of what's going on here. And in the civil law world, they call those policies. We don't call them policies, and we shouldn't. No, this is the thread, the golden thread, as one common lawyer said, that weaves through the warp and the woof of the text of our history as an Anglo culture. Now in America, I went today, just throw out a story, kind of fun. Well, it impressed me. That's why I'm going to mention it. I went to a place where the Salvation Army has a church, and they have a building, and they minister to a whole lot of people there that don't have nothing, they don't have anything to eat, don't have a place to take a shower, and they have a public shower outside that you can get hot water, and they collect tons of food wherever they can. But the fellow that was running the place, him and his wife, been married 39 years, he was 63 years old, and he's from Guatemala, and he said he landed in El Paso, Texas when he first came here, and his sponsor was a man in El Paso, and he said him and his wife were starving to death. He said, no, I mean, we didn't have anything to eat. And if it wasn't for the Salvation Army, we would have died, our children and us. And their children are now grown, and two of their boys are in the armed forces of the United States, doing very well. But he just smiled at me and told me how wonderful it was to be in America and how different it was and how much he loves the Bible. He's the pastor of that big church there, and it's a place where there are just a lot of poor Latinos. Of course, he speaks Spanish because he's from Guatemala, and I thought to myself, this fella has learned a whole lot about Anglo-American life, and he likes it because it was meant for him. He'd just been deprived of it, see, as a member of Adam's race, and now he's got it, and that's why America is here, and he's a benefactor in a very big, him and his wife. His wife teaches girls in that community how to cook. That's getting down to the ground of what our common law tradition is. Young girls that have babies don't know how to cook. She's teaching
nice.
Them.
Excellent.
He just went on. I wanted her to cook us a meal, but I didn't have time. I knew she could probably whip up a pretty good one. Yeah,
where's that church at?
That's the kind of thing that Well, I don't want to say because I don't want to reveal my location. But it's no place you're real close to right now.
Okay.
Because I know exactly where you are.
Well, I'd like to introduce my wife to them.
You came on and said, yeah, that Cody bought the house of a judge I used to argue cases in front of back home.
Yeah.
And I used to put that on that horse farm there where his family has there. I used to put up hay there every summer as a teenager. And then Cody, I ran into him. He called in on a show, and I got to ask him. It sounded like he knew about things I knew about. Of course, Cody, you're not from there, right? You're from someplace else. But
no, I'm from Dakota.
From the Dakotas, yeah, and the oil business. And at any rate, that's just a side note on a personal level. But back to you, Gerard, or whoever you
got
something
to say. Good evening.
Yeah, Cody.
Okay. Well, we're over.
Oh, we are.
We got one person in the queue, Jim. I'm gonna open it up and see what your question is, Jim, and hopefully I can answer it. And if I can't, maybe we'll address it next week. But go ahead. I want to end with an empty queue. Jim, go ahead. Yeah.
Jim in Pennsylvania. Question is, what can we do with these U.S. Marshals? Brent has given us an example of how they abuse their authority. And my personal experience was when I went down to the Pittsburgh Federal Building and confronted a U.S. Marshal. He did not have a name tag on, and he would not tell me his name. I told him I was going to use this for my affidavit. What can we do with these U.S. Marshals? I want to have respect for these people. I do not have respect for them after the information I know.
Well, that's because they don't have respect for the Constitution, right?
Yeah, and they don't have respect for themselves. People that abuse others are void of respect. I guarantee his wife kicks his butt. I know that sounds crass. I know it sounds like I am talking about something that, since I don't know him, but life has taught me that's the way it works. You show me a man that'll be abusive in public like that, and I'll show you a man whose wife runs over him and has no respect for him. That's the way life works. But let me say this about it, too. Mention about it. We don't respect people, if we're Christian men, we don't respect the other fella because he earns it. We respect the other fella because God orders us to. We want to do what our Maker tells us. Honor all men, period. That's all men. It doesn't say honor them if they act the way you think they ought to act. It doesn't say honor them if they don't abuse you. The question then comes, how do we honor men who abuse us? How do we honor men who do not accept our respect? How do I honor a federal judge who abuses me in court, who runs me down in front of my client? How do I honor a man like that? It takes a supernatural power to do what God tells you to do. But if you do that, it doesn't mean you always have to obey him. Honor does not mean obedience. It's a different thing. If you're going to disobey, you just make sure you do it honorably and respectfully. Respectfully. If my father tells me something or does something, my father is still alive, he's 95 years old. If he says something to me or gets nasty with me, I disagree with him, I'm not bound to obey him, but I certainly am bound to be respectful toward him at all costs. The same thing is true in the courtroom, and the same thing is true with U.S. Marshals. If it comes to them abusing you, it may get to the point, who knows, what if they try to kill you because you won't turn over your firearm? Or they're going to give you the jab. Then what do you do? Whatever you do, you don't be disrespectful, even if you have to defend yourself against another man. Even if you have to hurt another man, you don't abuse another man. You don't be disrespectful. That's the point I'm making. So I'm glad you brought it up. Now, this is one of the great difficulties of the Christian life. And you made the point. You said, I want to respect this fellow. Well, if you want to respect the other man, God put that in you, because that's a Christian principle. And respect of other people who are disrespectful toward you, I
as a member of the armed forces, I remember the officers that were disrespectful to other to men who saluted them. Fellows like that, unfortunately, sometimes don't last. But I'll say this also, that's not right either. The question again comes, just because the other fella, it isn't a quid pro quo. This isn't a contract. When God orders us to do something, that doesn't depend upon what somebody else does. That's the point I'm making. And you made it also, and I'm glad you did. Well,
still
it's
there?
Getting late.
We
lose? I don't want to keep everybody. Yeah, I'm here.
I think we lost.
No, I'm here.
Shucks.
No,
I'm going to get ready to close. I actually had a question for Brent. I had heard, and maybe we'll bring this up next week, or maybe Brent will come back on. He can answer this before we close. I had heard that when you're in court and you say, use the sentence and you say, I do not wish to be held in contempt, Your Honor, and then you say what you want to say, that he generally will not hold you in contempt, that that somehow binds him because you're showing respect.
Can you hear me, Gerard?
Yeah, is that true, that statement? So I was reading something, and I don't remember if it was, what's his name there, the guy that we learned common law from there. Something to the effect that if you say, I do not wish to be held in contempt, Your Honor, that kind of takes the wind out of the judge's sails, that usually they won't hold you in contempt as long as you frame it in that type of a sentence. Is that true?
That's substantially true. There are two kind of contempts in court. There's criminal contempt and non-criminal contempt. Criminal contempt is where you give the judge the finger and tell him where to stuff it. That's
right.
That's contempt to the face of the judge. Just consider, and judges are not God. I get it. But consider God. By the way, if judges are that way and our laws that way, and it's always been that way, how much more so with God?
Mm-hmm.
Be careful that you are not contemptuous toward your Maker.
Right.
Speak respectfully of Him and to Him. That's important. But if you disagree or your feelings are hurt, you know, come to Him humbly, God Himself, and say, I don't understand, Lord. I don't get it. I don't know what to do. Confess your ignorance and your inability, but don't be disrespectful. Well, the same thing with a judge. If you come to a judge, it's personal, friends. Judges and courts are not machines, and God didn't design them that way. Jurors are not machines. We don't want them to be machines. We want to go, and listen, it goes a long way. If I'm a judge, I'm not a judge, I've never been a judge, but if I were, and somebody came in cold and hard and didn't be personal and say, good morning, judge, well, that would have an effect upon the way I viewed that person and everything he says, and rightly so. That's we're men. That's the way God designed us. So when you go before the judge, even if he's disrespectful, whatever you do, the Bible says, thou shalt not speak evil. Now, that takes a little translation, the Hebrew words there, but what it means is you don't sass the judge. Don't sass the judge. Don't do that. No. Now, if you say, for example, if you tell him where to stuff it, that's criminal contempt, and you're going to get thrown in jail, you may even get tried for the crime of criminal contempt. But if you say, judge, with all due respect, I most respectfully decline to obey that order. I really believe in my heart of hearts that it's unlawful. And the judge may say, well, Mr. Winters, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to put you in jail, but I'm going to put the jailhouse key in your pocket. I'm going to put the jailhouse key in your pocket when I put you in the cell. And the jailhouse key is this. All you got to do is send word to me, would you please send word to me, that you've changed your mind and you're going to obey my order. Will you do that for me? Yeah. Now, our courts have said that if the jailhouse key is in your pocket like that, that's not even incarceration. You're not even being held in the jail. If you remember, and I use this example of Susan McDougall, because some of you might remember Susan. Susan was the one that was involved in the Whitewater controversy, and that conservative judge from Pepperdine, he'd been a federal judge, he's still around, I can't remember his name, very conservative Republican fella. Whatever it was, he was the special prosecutor in the Whitewater investigation in the Clinton years. And they wanted her testimony.
And the court ordered her to testify, and she took the Fifth Amendment. And the court said, well, in this case, you're not entitled to the Fifth. I don't remember what it was. Maybe they said, we'll give you complete immunity. Well, even though a court gives you complete immunity from prosecution, that doesn't mean that organized crime won't come after you if you testify. Well, she said, well, I still can't testify, Judge. I can't do that. My life's in danger. Well, I'm ordering you to. Well, with all respect, Judge, the attorney usually does the talking in those cases. That way you don't have to take a chance of saying something stupid like telling the judge off or making him mad. The judge finally said, well, Susan, I'm going to let you sit in jail. Now, this is all customary. And it's all personal, very personal contempt, and whether or not you're being held in contempt and whether it's criminal or non-criminal. In non-criminal contempt, you're put in jail to test your convictions. That's what it's for. The jailhouse key is in your pocket. You can get out anytime you want. All you got to do is tell the judge you change your mind. But if you don't change your mind, the custom is this. You'll sit there up to 6 months. Most cold cases, never more than 6 months. And then if you don't comply, the judge will say, okay, you're out. You proved your conviction. It could be, in rare cases, up to 18 months or somewhere in between. But hardly ever that I ever read of that it ever they ever kept you in for a non-criminal contempt more than 18 months. Now, that's very unpleasant. But that's what a freeman, has to be willing to do if he has conviction. They're testing the metal of your conviction. That's what non-criminal contempt is for. And it's part of our duty as American freemen to be willing to subject ourselves respectfully to that process. It's a tough process. It's the price we pay for being free. What do you do when there's a clash of wills and convictions about who's entitled to the Fifth and who isn't and how? And the judge disagrees with you. There it is. Well, I'm sorry it took so long, Gerard. I know it's time to quit.
That was good. That turned a light on a lot of stuff, and I'm sure people appreciate it.
Yeah.
So thank you, everybody. I'm going to close out. I don't want to go too long, but we got to the meat of the issue anyway. I feel. Thank you, Brent. Thank you, everybody. Keep your prayers up for the nation, and we'll see you here next week, same time.
Thank you, Gerard. We'll see you.